This ability to keep that fire going was a technology that nobody else knew. By observing the fire, by keeping it going, by creating ceremonies around this fire, they became a mystery to the others. A mystery always holds sway over those who don't understand it. And the priesthood was born. No king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. And I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power, and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be of benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 26th of January 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream. That address will take you straight to the stream if you ever want to have a listen. At radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, too, and also live on our app, Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Available free from all good app stores. Especially the best one is this thing called Aurora, which is a replacement for Google Play, which has got all the stuff that Google don't want you to have, plus all the unedited by Google versions of things like Telegram. So Aurora is what you can get. Just download that. If you can uninstall Google Play, all the better. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda this week, saying we're going to be conscripted, apparently, to go and fight the Russians. Well, I'd like to see that one. And the psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. So, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, these so-called solutions to almost every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, cost of living, climate, the twisted accelerationist, the Armageddonist policy is designed to make every crisis worse, it seems. Helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's fourth industrial revolution, the fourth Reich matrix, whatever you want to call it, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also from the allotmenteers Resist here in Bristol, Mal Sainsbury. So let's start with you, Mal. I mean, we're going to be talking a bit about Hinkley Point in a little while, and we've also got an exclusive interview with the Iraq war whistleblower Catherine Gunn talking about GCHQ and its role today. There's a big demonstration down there by the trade unions tomorrow, which I hope to be covering. But Mal, let's start with these allotments. I met you on Wednesday evening outside the council house, and you had a megaphone in your hand.
I did. There were hundreds of us turned up, and it's all about how Bristol City Council introduced a consultation on December the 11th. I'm sure it was time to actually go over the holiday period with the end date of 22nd of January, which we managed to push forward to the end of this month. And it was full of the most extraordinary proposals to, in some cases, quadruple rents on allotments and change all the rules and regulations that would actually be of huge damage to wildlife and to generations of allotment people as we know it. So we took our pitchforks up and we went down to the council house because it was the allotments forum having a meeting that night, and hundreds of us turned up, and yes, I think we made our feelings felt.
Martin, this is a basic service the council should be providing pretty much at cost. Yet what they're saying is we're going to crank up the prices for every allotment. Also loads of regulations about things like ponds. You're not going to be able to have a pond. If you do want a pond, you're going to have to pay extra.
I haven't followed it as closely as Mel has, but the main issue I've always pointed out in these situations is why have the council got no money? And they've got no money because the central government doesn't give the council enough money, and therefore they've got to find other ways to make up the money, and that's why they come up with all this stuff. And of course there is money. It was spent on bailing out the banks, and that's where it went, and that's literally how it works. we end up with all the things we need, like allotments or National Health Services or whatever, underfunded. Meanwhile, there's any amount of money for war, as we're going to discuss later. And, of course, the real problem is that we bailed out the private banking system, and then they carried on doing exactly what they were doing previously, which is exactly what they've done.
Well, I think this squeeze on money and the lack of money has made them turn their eyes to where they can make money.
That's
so,
right.
Of course, the allotments were, you know, ridiculous. It's not just allotments. It's the residence parking zones, yep. which they're about to increase. It's all been passed and signed off from £54 a car right up to £178 a car. They focused on, it was down at the harbour side when they were quadrupling people's moorings down there. Yep. And I think they looked at the Roots allotments, which is an entrepreneurial, privatised thing happening at Abbotsley. And they looked at that as then they shaped their model of this consultation on that. Now, the people are battling against that one out there because it's literally, it's selling us back our own land at 10 to 12 times the price. So basically, we have a statutory right to our allotments. It's our land, and what they're trying to do is make a buck, basically. And in the process, they don't seem to be caring about the fact that, you know, they haven't consulted us at all. So basically, all the decades of expertise and experience and knowledge of people who have been growing, not just growing their own food, because allotments, I think we all understand, especially during COVID and the lockdown, some people don't have gardens. And this was actually a sanctuary and an oasis for people. People with mental health problems, people with health issues of all kinds, elderly people, people who have, you know, all the kinds of people that need to be out in the open air teaching the generations. And one of the awful rules and regulations in the new rules, 35 pages of nonsense, actually, and was that you could only have one co-worker that you paid for, like you'd pay for cold frames, sheds, ponds, anything. And otherwise, you couldn't have any helpers. You couldn't have your children or family or people come to help you.
Well, let's just have a listen to, because there's been quite a bit of coverage in the local press about this. Many, many people mystified as to how the council, which is supposed to go to all these green policies, can also do these things to remove people from the allotments.
Yeah. For many, these allotments on the edge of Bristol are an opportunity to escape the city and grow their own. But with the proposal of allotment rent increases, that could be under threat.
It makes me feel really sad, and it makes me feel angry as well. It makes me feel that they don't actually know about this place or care about it.
The new charges, which Bristol City Council has put to consultation, sees fees rise by more than 50%. Plot holders Holly and Sally say after 7 years of hard work, this could force them off the land.
But this rent increase will over double our plot rents combined. And I think that's going to mean us looking at which plot realistically we can actually keep.
Proposals also include additional fees for having sheds and greenhouses, as well as keeping chickens and bees. But campaigners say this should be accessible to all.
We need this. There are so many diverse people here. There are widowers that come down just because they're lonely. They want to talk to somebody. Young families are trying to teach their children. This is where food comes from. Not out of a tin, where you go to a supermarket. You can actually grow nutritious food here.
For Tracy and Paul, the allotment is their sanctuary.
We've really enjoyed it coming down here with the silence, the quiet, the bird song.
We can sit here sometimes and just look out and see how beautiful Bristol is. You don't get that where we live. We live on a main road where you've got motorbikes racing up and down the road morning, noon and night.
Bristol City Council has said proposed changes to allotment fees is subject to a consultation that's open until the 22nd of January, and the proposals are only one part of a wider draft parks and green spaces strategy. Site rep Lizzie says owning an allotment shouldn't be a luxury.
Well, it's going to be gardening for the elite, I think. And it'd be such a shame because we need these allotments to be used.
She also runs a community farm, which would be at risk of closure.
We fund this ourselves, and we're going to be non-for-profit. We just want to provide a space and grow food for the community. And I think once people realise it's too expensive to do something like this, they won't bother. They won't bother to visit farms like this. They won't bother to take on an allotment, and they certainly won't bother to grow their food.
Until the consultation comes to a close, the potential for food growing opportunities in Bristol hangs in the balance. Verity Wishart, ITV News.
So, Mel, we just heard there on the ITV News version of events. What strikes me about this is we've got a council election coming up in May. and presumably the Greens are in a strong position to win that council election, surely they should be standing up and saying, we want to keep these allotments.
They are. We had all the Green councillors are completely on side. But of course, when this gets signed off and agreed at the meeting on, it'll be March the 5th, I believe, when Marvin will sit down to sign off this. I noticed it said the consultation was ending on the 22nd of January in the Voices then. But in fact, it's been extended because of the pressure we put on to the end of the month. So I would advise everybody to go and have a look at that and put their voice in. And also go to the petition, which you can find online if you just Google Bristol Allotmenteers Resistance, and just put your voice in as well, because these things are so important. And once we've lost them, we've lost them. It would take the Greens a long, long time to unpick this. It would be generations of people, and allotment growers would lose so many rights. And I think what would happen is that before the elections in May, Marvin, our mayor, can actually overturn any decision, so his word says. So if this is signed off, I think it's going to take a long, long time to unpick it.
But surely the Greens could promise if you vote for it, I suppose in actual fact it would still be enforced, wouldn't it, for quite a while before they formed an administration.
Yes. Yep.
And then they'd have to bring forward legislation, as it were, to change it and redo it. So once it's a fait accompli, lots of people are going to drop out. And then the whole, then they've achieved their goal of kind of destabilising the situation.
This covers the whole of Bristol, of course. We have over 4,000 allotments are managed by the local authority, and then we have about 1,500 which are actually cooperative models that don't have to answer to the council. Mm-hmm. And I think that certain parts of Bristol are, it's a bit of a battle between the Greens and Labour at the moment, isn't it? So I think the Labour response to supporting the allotments resistance has been a bit lukewarm, to be quite honest.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, and I'm a member of the Labour Party, I would suggest that they oughtn't to do that because they're going to lose the election. But it doesn't seem to have crossed their minds that that's the sort of thing they need to do, does it?
Well, and also because, the whole Labour Party values are all about, the levelling up thing, which, of course, never happened under Boris, did it? But the thing is that allotments are an incredibly important part of accessibility for all of us. Things like, having equality and diversity, it really does cross all those boundaries and borders. Mm. And we want to protect it. I mean, seeing the demonstration of people, there were people there that were representing their elderly parents who couldn't come. Yeah. There were people of every age and but also we, amongst our, we're not just green fingered, we've got barristers and we've got solicitors, so we're prepared to fight.
I'm just saying, presumably they still find difficult, there are people who want to have allotments who can't get them, so that, you've still got more demand than actual supply.
Well, the onus should be on the council to provide more allotments.
Yeah.
And we've been mismanaged because, it's not ring-fenced, all the rents and everything. Their department has gone down to one person, and they're talking about these rent increases funding another person. Mm. But this person would actually be, I suppose, policing all the rules, because any infringements, they want to replace these people and put more affluent people who don't mind about these increased rents.
Yes, I suppose that's probably it. It's just making it a more desirable good, but the poor people won't get access to it for the reasons you've just said. If it's too expensive, they can't afford it.
I mean, just to give you an example of how unreachable it is for people, if you now get yourself on top of the waiting list and you're offered an allotment, it'll cost you just about £200 just to move on before you've lifted a fork. Yeah. And that's because you have a registration fee, you register you're allowed one co-worker, not anymore, and then you haven't even started to think about another £25 to put a cold frame on a raised bed. The pond thing is absolutely ludicrous. They said that you can't have a pond more than a metre across or 50 centimetres deep, when everyone knows it's got to be 75 centimetres to avoid the freezing. And why we need our ponds is because of the wildlife. We need all our newts. We want to, because what we need to do is actually look at the modern ways that we grow things now. We have companion plants, we have medicinal herbs, that kind of thing. And in these old-fashioned rules that they've drawn, I don't know who wrote all these rules, but they've got things like no wildflowers. I mean, what is a wildflower?
Bizarre, isn't it?
Isn't it bizarre?
I mean, you'd have thought that, and also for the fact that they haven't consulted anybody. Presumably, I was just going to ask, I mean, has this galvanised a kind of community of, I mean, obviously there is a community of people who go to allotments, but I imagine a lot of people don't necessarily talk to everybody. You just go to your allotment, don't you? But something like this brings people together and, you know, you've created an organisation
to resist. I mean, but there are communities within communities, and we have lots and lots of cooperative people who grow things for food banks, who work together with disadvantaged people to be able to learn new skills about, you know, it's so important, isn't it? And it's so...
Well, a lot of people on community service end up going to work in places like this, don't they?
They do, that's right. And the fact is that it's not just about growing food. Now, the 1908 Small Holdings and Allotments Act says very clearly, because we're post-war here, about growing your own food. But of course, in those days, they used a lot of sort of pesticides and things, and we have modern ways of no dig, and we have modern ways of not using pesticides and that kind of thing. And so things do need updating. But what the Bristol City Council have done is rehash some really, really awful old rules and regs.
So no sympathy for permaculture there, then?
No, not at all. No.
We're not going to have permaculture.
I mean, when they say about removing children's play equipment... It, you know, a swing on a tree. The worst thing, of course, is the wildlife, because, you know, we have our wildlife corridors, and the idea that we were instructed in the transitional bit before it all becomes in 15 months or whatever to start cutting down trees and hedges, absolutely disgraceful. And one of the things that we found ludicrous was the idea, because who could afford this, that you replace your glass greenhouses with plastic panels. Now, you know this, what was the name of the storm that we had the other day?
I can't remember, but it was bad enough to break a plastic panel or rip
it
away.
Well, they just were in tatters the next day. It was just ridiculous. So,
I mean, what's the logic behind that? I mean, is glass dangerous in some way?
Well, there are shards of glass from previous things in the soil that need to be cleared up, and people have done that.
Yeah.
It's not poisonous, and it's certainly not plastic.
I thought plastic would probably be more deleterious than glass.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, I'm just dredging up my knowledge about this subject. I mean, there was some, maybe it's the one you mentioned earlier, where it's basically a private company was going to set up a whole load of allotments in North Somerset or in...
Yeah,
Baines.
They had a lot of objection to that. Well, basically,
what was that all about?
It's called Roots Allotment, and the people over in Abbots Lee have been fighting it, not because they don't want people to share and grow. They've got Chris Packham on side, which is great. We've got Hugh Fernley Whittlestall on our side as well, because the whole wildlife corridor bit is incredibly important and not been thought through. And those people, I mean, they are entrepreneurs, and they've seen how you can make some really good dosh out of this, can't you? So what they're doing is selling back our own it's private land, but they're developing into it. I think it's about 700 plots over there. They, after the third attempt, I think North Somerset granted the planning permission, but with no car park. I mean, when you compare the prices, and what Bristol did was peculiar, because they said that it was comparative and that it was reasonable. But in fact, it wasn't comparative to comparative cities like Liverpool or Manchester. They were looking comparatively, benchmarking, rather wealthy London boroughs. So it was very, you know, it would make us the most expensive in the country. People can't afford that kind of thing. We need to have the rights of... Because the allotments are supposed to be considered by councils to be recreational leisure facilities.
Yeah.
So you're not supposed to be making huge profits on them. They're supposed to be low cost, no profit.
No, but of course there are various mechanisms by which the officers have been trying to kind of pad the budget out. And of course the political side of the council, they want to be re-elected, so they need some funds to push in the directions of the things, you know, their pet projects and so on.
Yes.
And, of course, when you've got an elected mayor... But this is what make. I was always opposed to elected mayors, but I'm still opposed to them, really, because what we've argued about whether we should or shouldn't have an elected mayor, when the actual capacity of local government is just being stripped away completely.
Yes.
I mean, ultimately, we've seen Birmingham has gone bankrupt.
Yeah.
And lots of other cities and towns are going to go bankrupt, and the central government will then have to step in and sort it all out. And we're arguing about how we should elect the captain of the Titanic of the sinking ship and how much power they should have. I mean, it's absurd. And although there is some aspect, I'm going off topic here, but it's all related, everything's related to everything else, is that you've seen that both Sadiq Khan and Andy Burnham have been able to take lines oppositional to Starmer, for example, over the Iraq war, not the Iraq war, the Gaza war. And also... because they've got an independent power base in Manchester and London, they're able to say stuff which people who are on the conveyor belt can't say. But on the other hand, they're never going to have any power beyond what they've got in the cities that they're in.
Yes. These people that are elected into public positions, they need to be working towards the benefit of the communities that they serve.
Yeah.
And our community is a great big one. I think they've bitten off more than they can chew with us. This is going to go on for a long time, but we're not going to give up the fight. And my message to everyone is to stay angry, stay focused and keep fighting. And I would urge everyone to sign that petition. Who cares if you've got an allotment or not, but actually who cares about green open spaces? Because as I keep saying, these are the green lungs of our city. And once we lose them, my goodness, we're going to suffer then.
Can I just ask you about the petition? Because I think there's no difference between people inside and outside the city signing it.
Yes, Holly, who started up our petition, it was on a change.org thing, and basically wanting to get to the 3,500 signatures, which we've passed over 5,000 now, but you've got to have a Bristol postcode for it to be debated and discussed in the council. So basically, we're kind of like urging people to sign it and put in their Bristol postcode. A lot of people have. I think we need more, though.
One thing I'd like to say about the whole allotment business is it's not their land.
No, it's our land.
Our
yeah.
land.
Yes.
And I'm sorry if you've already said that, but I just think it needs to be said. They are holding this land for us as stewards of that land. And if they don't behave themselves, we are going to have it back.
Well, I think we're going to have to take direct action. We are, because if they're not going to talk to us, I mean, what we want is we want to keep allotments affordable. We want to protect ecology with kinder horticultural systems, which I was saying to Martin about the old-fashioned rules don't apply to us anymore. We want to stand up for equality, diversity and inclusivity for tenants. We want to work together to create reasonable and mutually workable allotment rules, which they haven't consulted us at all, of course. And we want to build the understanding with a proper consultation process. Now, what they're suggesting now is they're going to do a workshop of stakeholders and site reps to slightly alter the rules and change things that are the most contentious rules, they say. But there's no time to do that. We need this proposal and consultation to be scrapped and done properly and done fairly, yeah. Consulting people. So we're urging the council to, because it's not time to do it otherwise. End of this month is the end of the consultation. And then before you can say knife, it'll be the end of Marvin's ruling.
Or trowel.
Or trowel, actually, yes.
Yes.
Resistance is fertile is our logo.
So let's just make this as clear as possible, is that this has just been kind of, there's been no kind of proper consultation about this. They're just now saying to people, and the most amazing thing in a way for me, looking at all this from the outside, as not an allotment holder, but someone who very much loves allotments, is that the site reps are going to be apparently doing the policing. So they'll be going kind of with a clipboard around all the allotment sites in the city, saying unauthorised puddle, unauthorised fence, unauthorised post sticking up out of the ground, tick that down. The council can't really be expecting volunteers.
They're volunteers as well. And also it's a divide and rule them and us, isn't it? I mean, site reps, they get their plot free. But it's all voluntary and they do far more work than they're ever, you know, that could ever be covered. And the idea that you'd start to grass your allotment neighbour up because they've got a child's swing or their pond is a bit too deep, or, you know, you'd need to be sort of flying drones over, dropping notices to quit, wouldn't you, to be? Because we don't really know what would happen if we just refused to cooperate. And if the site reps decide not to cooperate, it's unenforceable.
Well, Wednesday was a very good turnout outside the City Hall, several hundred people with placards and generally speaking not particularly vicious instruments of tillage stood there lobbying people as they went into the allotment forum, and I spoke to several individuals about how these changes would affect them.
I'm Patricia and this is my husband Mark, and we're here obviously allotment growing we've been doing for quite a while now at the site we're at. We've been there since 2016, Whitefield Road, and we're passionate about growing and really incensed by the changes that the council want to impose on people. I don't agree with it. They're making it accessibility difficult for those who are already there. They talk about sustainability in their policies, but then they're going against the grain of what they're saying. they want to put over 100% increase in charges, what people couldn't afford. It's a place of a retreat. It helps people with their health issues, being outside in the climate, the wildlife and everything that's there. It's great benefits to all of us. Yeah, it's a community at the sites where people go, and there's people maybe elderly or disabled or whatever, and you might not have friends or family, but it's a place to go, it's a retreat. You can spend time with other people and get to build a friendship, you know what I mean? In terms of the things that they want to do, they want to reduce existing size of plots and make it smaller. To me and a lot of people, it's all about money, recouping costs for a badly managed system within the city council. We all pay our taxes anyway. With the allotment side of things, there's people who are recruited to do a job. If they're not doing their job properly, that shouldn't come back on us. At the end of the day, they've got a policy that should be able to protect their interests as Bristol City Council. So if you breach one of those conditions that you've signed up, which is a legal document, a tenancy agreement, why then do they think they can say, if you're a joint tenant, you need to decide between the two of you who's going to be the tenant and then move to creating the other one as a co-worker? Would they do that with an actual housing council tenancy? No, I don't think so. Neither a garage tenancy that you may have, and similar other things, agreements. You can't do that. So why are they going to try and bamboozle people to make a decision which would greatly affect them? There's no guarantee that if the tenancy comes to an end, they're going to allow the co-worker to take it on board. They talk about the glass and replacing the glass in a greenhouse because broken glass across the site. But actually, if there is a blizzard or somebody smashes a glass, it's going to be contained to one area. It's not actually going to be throughout the growing space. And if you have a plot and you see that a pane of glass is broken, you're going to make sure you clean that up. Any glass that's in the ground is historic glass. Yeah, as is bricks and all of these things that people have found and put years and years of effort into maintaining that site that they have, and they're growing vegetables, not only for their family, but it could be the community that they live in, and family members. Yeah?
So what do you grow on your site?
Cool. Go on, you say.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, like potatoes, pumpkins, courgette. We do squash, we do things like we try and plant Caribbean stuff. We plant sweet potatoes, which is very good, and we plant things like chocho, Caribbean thing, a lot of peppers, you know, Caribbean side kind of scotch bonnet peppers, and as I say, loads of tomatoes and honey and garlic. We have apples, we have all kind of berries, and those things we reap sometimes. Like we do like rich chards and all that, and that is a benefit to even the community, because we take it out most of the times, go around and give it away to people who is less fortunate, and older people who can't even help themselves to go and do that. So for us, it's a haven for ourselves, help with emotional stress and everything. So all these things that we grow, it's just good, and that people who don't go the same thing as us, originally born in the Caribbean, people are amazed with the things that we do, and we kind of share that kind of things with other people, and eat flowers. So now I don't even have to buy flowers again for my rest of my life. So I go and cut flowers for my wife every time. And that's just a space where sometimes we get out of the house and I just go up there to go by our allotment plot to do work and just make things right. And my wife comes, is already done. So yeah, we grow very very kind of different variety of stuff.
So do you think events like this today might change the council's mind?
I hope so. But sometimes if they're set in their ways, they might go against the people, which they shouldn't go against the people, because if the people speak, they should listen.
And the people pay their wages.
Yes, exactly. And it's not about profiting, making a profit for the council or whatever it is. For us, it's about that generational thing. So we've got children and grandchildren who are part of our community up there. When we're doing something, we If we include all of those, we, the family that come, we're already outside of the number that they're saying you then need to ask permission to gather on your plot, which is ridiculous. On our site, every year they have a function, yeah, a community function. We have an allotment association up there, and people who are residents, the local community, they're also invited to come and see what we grow. And we might put on a barbecue and have a social event. Now, if you've got to go to the council and ask permission for that, when it's never created a problem before in all of these years, why now are you imposing that? For us, we come from a Caribbean family. So our family is large. So then we're going to be marginally affected by that. And many other people who take it serious. So we have a barbecue on our site. So when we use it, obviously, for gatherings, we invite the family. They come and they help to harvest. If they come and they assist, then they always can take something home. But we cook, we reap and we cook and present, not just to our families, but if there's other plot holders there and they want to trial something that they perhaps haven't grown, then we will share that and they get food as well. So I don't agree with that aspect of it either, you know?
No, I think the problem is, though, I mean, what do you think the council can be turned around on this one?
I think so. I mean, if they look at the bigger picture, and if you have already got an established community on site, then they can look at things on a site-by-site basis. If you're not creating a nuisance and an annoyance of any sort and affecting your local neighbours in the area, why should that present a problem? If no one on the site is complaining that you're causing a problem, it shouldn't be an issue because, as I said already, they've got their tenancy agreement where they can take action if necessary.
Thanks very much.
That's Patricia and her husband speaking on Wednesday at the protest. I think, in a way, she's painted there, Mal, an amazing kind of situation where you've got an extended family involved, you've got neighbours involved, you've got fellow plot holders involved, people actually being fed by this community food system. Now, if the council want to slowly push people off the plots, particularly the poorer, this surely is a, you know, at the moment the council might listen, they might do something. We've got a potential little peasants' revolt going on here.
We certainly have, yes. But I mean, what was being said just then, not just about asking the council permission to actually have your family and have a little celebration or whatever it is at harvest time, the council want to charge you for that. You know, it's yet another charge that they're putting on. It's absolutely ludicrous when you read all the small print. And I think that consultation was put together in a way that really did confuse people, because there were lots of links on it that led you to read the small print, and some of the small print rules are really, anyone that grows food, and you can't have a one size fits all set of rules. Plotman, you know, as that lady was saying, that, you know, all the sites are different, and some are on level places and some are on slopes and some have shaded trees that mean that they have to do different things under those, and you just can't have a one size fits all.
No, and it's not just the ethnic minorities in the city that this is affecting. I spoke to some people from Shirehampton. Frank.
My name's Reeve Jordan. I'm here to kind of just get a part of the allotment protest because I think it's an absolute disgrace what the council are trying to do. Yeah, that's why I'm here.
You should explain for people that don't know what they're up to.
Well, as far as I'm aware, they're hiking up the prices, introducing ridiculous rules that are just, well, mental.
Do you have your own allotment?
My father here.
Hiya, I'm Frank Jordan.
His allotment and
Layhill, Shirehampton.
A lot of my friends go up there to help out. It's a nice place, and I think they're trying to introduce something, a cost or something for other people going up to help out, which, to be honest, you know, people have health problems, you've got to help out maintain allotments. So I just think it's a disgrace.
Can you give us an idea of why people want an allotment these days? Most people are too busy.
Yeah, well, mainly for relaxation, I find. I mean, although it can be hard work, they're very relaxing places to go to. You know, you've got your own place, it's quiet generally, you can do your own thing, and it's just a nice getaway from life itself.
Okay. What do you actually manage to produce there?
Well, everything, beans, carrots, chilies, potatoes, spinach,
herbs.
Herbs, bait.
On this particular allotment, there is a pond, which is a great crested newt breeding site, and under the council's new rules, that would have to be taken away.
Yeah, we've also had bees. We had those for a couple of years, although we had to get rid of some Italian bees because they're quite aggressive. We've also had geese. We looked after three geese for the best part of 15 years. So allotments aren't just about carrots. There's all sorts of things going on there. And I've got to say, the people there are generally really nice people. They're for sharing with you, sharing their knowledge, sharing the seeds, sharing the produce when they overproduce as well. It's just a great place to be. With
nice council will say there's a big waiting list, and if they up the prices, then some people will drop out. It will enable some new people to come in.
Yeah, there's always been new people coming in, and to be perfectly honest,
576 vacant allotments. This says yeah. So.
I would believe that there's always been vacant allotments at our site. And sure enough, when we first got it 15 years ago, there was a lot. These days, you know, it's the new rock and roll, so there is more. I'd say it's about 80%, but it's never ever full. There's always places for new people coming in.
So what you're implying is that although there's people waiting, the council aren't putting them on the new plot.
I wouldn't even imply it. I'd say it's just a fact. The council aren't doing any
absolutely spot on. And I'm not saying it's the people's fault who are working there. They've got a very small department. They don't work a lot of the time. And it's a massive job. And when I first got the allotment, I think there was 5 full-timers there. Now there's 2 part-timers. They've not put the money in. It's a typical council thing. They need to invest in it, really, so they can process these things and get them turned over a lot quicker.
This mayor has only got another couple of months to run. Do you think you'll turn this around before the Greens get in?
This mayor, first of all, the Greens won't get in. Second of all, this mayor is absolutely hopeless. He has done nothing for this city. He has been too busy trying to get his name in the press. He has been wasting money on this ridiculous underground system, which was never going to happen. Think about the money just wasted on that, that could have been invested in services like the allotments and all the other things that we are desperately in need of in this city.
We love Marvin.
I hate it.
And the question is, can you turn it round before a new lot comes in?
No, it won't be done. Everything with the council takes far too long. It's just the way. And I've worked for the council before.
Previously worked for them. They are useless.
It is. It's a very, really, really difficult thing to get anything done quickly. Even if, you know, the people that are in there actually want to do it quickly, it just doesn't happen.
My name's Caroline, I'm at Metford Road Community Orchard, and I'm here because the proposed changes are so restricted and have such a massive impact on the reality of the orchard being able to run, that we need to see some kind of better collaboration over moving things forward.
Okay, so can you describe what you're doing and how these changes would affect you?
How it'll affect us, the rent will double. We're a small membership organisation, so one thing is around rent and the cost. The more major thing is that people will be restricted from coming. It'll put the onus on one or two sort of volunteers to monitor the activities of others who are involved. It's completely impossible to manage. So fundamentally, the orchard would not be able to operate in light of that. And then there's all sorts of effects around. There's silly restrictions, like it's an old orchard. It's been there for decades, and they're saying trees have to be spaced and of a certain height, and things that don't make any sense. So some communication, collaboration to try and understand what they're trying to get out of it would be really helpful.
Well, one of the reasons the council are doing this is because they've got an enormous great waiting list. They're trying to get the people who aren't quite so committed out of the way to let some of these new people in.
I don't really understand how that affects Community Orchard, because it's a membership organisation without restricted membership. Plus, the allotments in the site we're at, adjacent to, are fully looked after, used and productive. So I can't understand. I'm sure that there are some around the city where there's problems, but you're using a sledgehammer to break a nut. And so I don't really understand the way they're going about it.
What's your sense of how this has all been received the last month or so and today?
I think that the opportunities for responses have been very short. It seems to have been published for responses before Christmas at a time when people aren't really necessarily on the ball of what's happening. And when we've tried to communicate our concerns, we've got some mixed messages back, you know, from certain people saying, oh, it's never going to go through in the way it's in presented, in which case, why bother presenting it in that way? So I think collaboration has been poor.
What about today?
You mean how effective it is? Or no, it's great. It's very good to be part of a group of people who are interested in being listened to. And let's hope they are listened to.
I'm Jules, and I'm here because I've had my allotment since 2009. Worked really hard on it, and just feel that a lot of the proposals in the council's document aren't really, they're a kind of odds with what I've sort of over the years gathered in terms of information about, you know, wildlife, biodiversity, what an allotment is for. It's not just for food necessarily. It's a lovely space a lot of people have, bring their kids, you know, start a new generation of growers. That, you know, that's what it's about. And this document seems to sort of ignore a lot of those facts, I think.
The council say there's a big waiting list of people wanting to use the allotments. I think they're effectively saying, well, let's clear a few people out of the way and let some new people in.
That's a valid point. We were just talking about that just now. I mean, I think the allotment office is very understaffed. They've got a big lack of capacity, and I think that's possibly why the waiting list is so long. There are empty plots on our site, but on the other hand, maybe they're not as... they're not as efficient as they could be in kind of allocating new plots. But I do understand that maybe capacity is low.
Say something about the community of allotment people, because you've got your friend here.
Thank you.
But I just think I get the sense that when you go, it's a little bit like when you go to the local park every day, sometimes you're bumping into the same people.
Yeah. Oh, that's definitely true. I mean, I've got to know my immediate neighbours and people further afield. And I've learned so much from people. You know, it's a real community of growers. People sharing tips, giving advice, swapping seeds, plants, surplus produce. You know, it's an amazing thing to be part of. That's not to say that these proposals would destroy that, but like my neighbours next door to me have put up a trampoline for their little girl, and because they want to kind of encourage her to come, not just to grow things, but children of 9 or 10, you know, they might need a little bit of an extra incentive. And if the council is saying that play things or play objects have to be removed, I think that's really counterproductive.
My name's Noelia. My mum and I and a couple of others are here from Eastern Community Garden. So we don't have an individual private allotment. We share 3 allotments for the benefit of the community. It's open to everyone, so we're part of the solution. We provide a lot of benefits to getting people into growing, if maybe they're on a waiting list for an allotment but they can't access it. We're really the solution to the problem, and we don't agree with a lot of the things proposed, because between us we have a lot of experience in growing and permaculture, and there's just not any benefit really to any of the things proposed.
Would you like to maybe point to one or two of the proposed changes that you don't agree with?
Sure. So for example, the ponds, obviously it's really, really detrimental to wildlife, especially frogs and pollinators, and the trees as well. So we have, which a lot of our other fellow community gardens have, if you have like an orchard or a couple of trees that you look after and you maintain, then there should be no reason to cut them down. It doesn't make any sense. The trees especially, we're very passionate about.
There's more and more. So what's your thoughts about where this is all heading, Mal?
I think we've got to keep fighting, because we need to fight not just for this generation of allotment holders. We need to just make sure that we retain our independent authority to grow what we like, where we like, when we like, and to draw on those incredible generations of knowledge of growers. And we need the council to be properly consulting with us. We want this consultation scrapped completely until after the elections, and then let's start again and see what happens from there.
Overall, Martin, this is really just part of the kind of fallout from 2008, though, you think?
Well, I mean, ultimately, yes, but that's a very wide point. Obviously, councils do have a very difficult road to hoe because of the financial circumstances. We were talking earlier about Birmingham going bankrupt and so on. But ultimately, of course, you've still got to manage what you're doing in a competent fashion, and this doesn't seem to be at all competent. But, of course, we've got an election in May, where this will be an issue, hopefully. And that's what the, you know, that's what local elections are supposed to be about. If they're not doing it right, kick the rascals out,
so,
isn't it?
What do you think? What will the Greens do when they take over in May, do you think?
Well, they already have a majority in our local authority, but they don't have any power, do they? We've spoken and been talking to they've been attending our meetings and been really supportive and fantastic. And they've said that they would consult with the people who have the expertise and knowledge all the way. And, of course, just the name itself, Green, isn't it? They have obviously got their sights set on. I mean, what's happening with this proposal is that lots of parts of it contradict the council's own policies on climate change and care of nature and all that kind of thing. And there's not even an equality impact assessment's been done on this, you know, for the inclusive elements of it. So we need to pull them up on this because, as Martin says, it's been mismanagement.
Do you know how many allotmenteers there are in the city?
Yes, I said a bit earlier, didn't I? There's over 4,000 allotments, and then another 1,500 that are not run by the council. They're amazing. There's lots in Horfield, in Ashton Vale, and they're actually cooperative models that are fantastic. Half the price, everyone's got a shed, beautifully run, fantastic. I mean, it'd be nice to take it all away from the
council. Who owns the land that they're operating on?
The council leases the people. And it's let to them for a peppercorn rent, which is actually nothing. They don't have the expense of having to administer it.
It's almost as if there's a bit of deja vu with the feelings from the North American Indians and the Aboriginals, the way that it was our land. These people, hundreds of years ago, took this land off of us and gave us a little bit of an allotment just to kind of keep us quiet, and now they seem to want to take that away too.
Well, that's why I think Bristol turned its eyes on this entrepreneurial roots allotment model to think, let's make some money out of this. I mean, we haven't even mentioned the goats, have we? I mean, goats are against the rules, and goats have played a huge part in lots of our allotments to keep bramble and all sorts of things back, and their natural food is the trees that the council want to cut down.
Yeah, well, we're going to hear finally from one of the speakers who talked about human rights on Wednesday evening outside the council.
The Human Rights Charter tells us that food is a human right, and yet all across the globe, people are fighting for the land to grow food on, not for wealth, but to feed their families and communities. 26.7% of Bristol's children live in poverty, and yet we have land aplenty. The aim of many community groups growing on allotment land in Bristol is to afford affordable, free, healthy and culturally appropriate food for their communities. And yet these draconian new rules, including the cost of setting up a project, will put a stop to those most in need from doing this. Restrictions of numbers of volunteers, co-workers and written permission to do something as simple as digging a pond puts communities on allotment land at risk of not being able to continue. But more than that, not allowing wildflowers, limiting tree planting and species, limits community projects from educating people about how food growing can go hand in hand with biodiversity gain and supporting mitigation of the climate. Over the centuries, Britain has seen movement after movement fighting for access to land to grow, and allotments are part of that movement. We need Bristol City Council to rethink this consultation with it, which is discriminatory, and bring together a citywide conversation from the grassroots up that acknowledges Bristol's opportunity to turn this around and be the face of city allotment growing in the future, rather than returning us to the past. Resistance is fertile.
I mean, this destruction of ponds and trees is one of the most amazing things, but what is it politically, do you think? Because this is coming right at the very end of the term of this Labour mayor. It's almost this kind of last kick of spite.
It doesn't look good, does it? but I think, talking about Martin's bigger picture, if you Google petitions, you'll see that over 400 petitions at the moment have the words allotment written in them. So this is not just us. It's happening all over the country. And basically, it's, as you said, Tony, it's taking away our right to our land, to our grow our own food. And basically, it's trying to regulate things that should be something that is a natural human right. The bigger picture is that we've slipped into something where we're in terrible, since 2008, where the councils have been squeezed to the bone, and they're looking to see not just where they can cut everything to the bone. I mean, what's happening with disability living allowances now, where people are, they call it warehousing, isn't it? Where they're saying that people that are able to live independently in their homes with the right assistance are now being, the money's being cut so that they are forced into residential care. Disgraceful. Mm. All the little caravans and people with cafes all along the cycle paths and everywhere are being asked to now contribute on top of their rent. And it's not just their profit. This is their complete takings, gross takings, 10-15% to the council. Councils are grubbing around trying to get money out of people, and they've turned their sights onto us and we as allotment holders. And in Bristol, a city famous for its civic disobedience, we're not going to have any of it. We're going to keep fighting. And hopefully, you know, set the model and the example for the rest of the country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's Bristol's reputation, is it not? And of course, we have got an election coming up where this can be one of the issues which will be discussed. And that is all to the good, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. Look, I mean, what do you think, whereabouts do you stand on all this politically? Are you a Labour Party member or anything like that?
I voted Labour all my life, and I'm, you know, very reluctant to give my support to the new campaigns, because politically I've found the values of the Labour Party have been drained. I mean, Bristol was a fantastically left-wing, there's no chance in the Bristol, it'll be Bristol Central, isn't it, of Conservatives getting in. But I think that the Greens have got a huge opportunity now to oust the Labour people who are just following the whip, telling them not to vote for things like the ceasefire. Mm. And we've got, you know, we've got some really pretty major people in Bristol.
I was quite amazed to see, just up the road in Gloucester, there were a whole load of Gloucester Labour councillors came out on one of these ceasefire Palestine marches with a big sign saying Labour councillors for a ceasefire. Here in Bristol, it's this, the one, I think isn't it, Zoe Goodman, she's come out and she's felt it necessary to resign from the local party because of her support for Palestine. So this does seem to be, there seems to be a sort of party whip going on, a little bit like the Tory one used to be.
Absolutely. Can I just put a plug in for tomorrow as well? Because I think it starts at 10 o'clock at Sainsbury's by Cabot Circus. There's going to be supporting Palestine, looking at the boycotting goods. And they're going to start at Sainsbury's. They're going into about 7 supermarkets, filling trolleys with Israeli goods that we shouldn't be buying. And they're going to end up at Barclays. But coming back to the allotments thing, can I just promote a little thing that's happening here that's a big community thing? At the Trinity Centre on Sunday the 11th of February from 12:30 to 4:30, there's a Bristol Seed Swap, which is a free event with seeds, talks, kids' activities. Please come along. Please come along and support us, because you'll see a lot of people there that are fighting for us to keep the right to grow our own food.
Well, Mel Sainsbury, thanks ever so much for coming along talking about allotments. I'll put all the links up to things like the petition, the Facebook page, the seed swap, and anything else we've been talking about here, particularly the petition, because you don't have to be in Bristol to sign it. And I think this is one of those things that we just cannot afford to lose. Another just final, I mean, the council constantly saying, oh, well, there's 6,000 people waiting for allotment plots. But what I was hearing from everybody is, well, there's a load of spare plots on our allotment. And the council aren't filling them. So something's going wrong somewhere. People are saying we want allotments. And at City Hall, they're not being allocated to people.
Absolutely. And you do find that people are on the waiting list for so long that their situations change. And when you approach them, a site rep approaches, they don't no longer want to apply for one because they're, you know, they've moved house or whatever. But the thing is,
it sounds like the NHS, maybe they die by the time they're going to get an allotment. I mean, this is ridiculous.
You've just reminded me, because Councillor Ellie King, who's the councillor, Labour councillor for Hillfields, she was saying in defence of the council's set up of this proposals and that. It was like a done deal. She said, well, you know, the allotment holders will have 15 months to be able to adapt to the changes, and it is all for the best, and etc. And I was thinking, excuse me, how can the wildlife adapt? They're going to die.
Adapt or die.
Adapt or die.
Oh, no. That's the council slogan for the allotment campaign. Anyway, yeah, Mal Sainsbury, thanks ever so much for joining us. We're going to have a listen now to a little bit from Barton House. There's been a protest about that outside City Hall today. Our mayor isn't all that popular amongst Bristol citizens.
Hello, my name is Fadimo. I'm one of the campaign leaders for Barton House residents. I am asking everyone to come Friday the 26th at 12:30 in front of Barton House. We will have people from two mosques who will march with us. We want you to come and support us. The council has refused to have a meeting with us. We tried everything to contact them and arrange meetings. They completely refused. They haven't been treated as properly. We need to march and show them that we are a community, strong together, and we need the support from the community. We need the support from Bristol people, and we want to show them that we say no to their plans. Justice for Barton House. We will fight, and we're not going to go down easily.
So that's about today's protest. Barton House, Martin's going to be another big disaster. I know you like to get your teeth stuck into these Middle East wars and things like that, but we've got now apparently £5.5 million has been spent by the City Council on moving everybody out. moving everybody out of Barton House and then moving them back in again. There was apparently no problem in the first place.
Well, when we had George Ferguson on here, if you remember, a few weeks ago, he was saying that it was the fire brigade that had initiated this by saying that there was a safety issue. Now, I don't know the truth or the otherwise of that, but okay, I mean, if that's the case,
it
was a googly
there was
ball.
There was a safety test the council was supposed to have done 3 or 4 years ago at the time of Grenfell, and it was at a point where in between two different chief executives, and it kind of got lost. It never got done.
Yeah.
And so when the communities and local government department, the main government department that looks into all this, said, where's your report? They said, oh, we haven't got one. They said, well, you can't, you know, that's dangerous. You have to do this report. You can't just not have done it. At which point the fire brigade said, well, it's potentially unsafe, you know, if you haven't done your report. So it was just simple negligence by the council. It's the same sort of things we were hearing from these allotment keepers. The council's just not up to the job.
Well, I think what's the problem, often the decisions about things like this are made by officers, and it's not even a political level decision. So, you know, and people make mistakes or sins of omission and all the rest of it. I mean, the allotment issue, it sounds like some officer has just sat down and written what he wants to see happen or she wants to see happen. And then it's just been turned into policy without any discussion, serious discussion at all. And the same thing happened with Barton House. But I mean, Harold Macmillan years ago was asked, well, what's the problem about politics? And he said, well, events, dear boy, events. You think you've got a plan, and then things happen that you didn't predict, and you don't know what to do.
I get the very distinct idea that actually what's happening is people are not being recruited to work at Bristol City Council, certainly in the top couple of tiers of management of council officers, that actually have any real qualifications or know what they're doing at all. They're friends of friends, and this kind of cliquey nepotism is the sort of thing that leads to these decisions being not made or things left undone by people who aren't really qualified. And I suppose I could say the same about the biggest white elephant on the planet, pretty much, which is Hinkley Point C. This week, this nuclear power station, the third version of nuclear power down at Hinkley, near Minehead, on the Bristol Channel, not far from here, Hinkley Point C has been delayed again, and project costs have rocketed. And I'm joined on the line by Roy Pomfrey from the Stop Hinkley campaign. Roy, you guys have been going ever since since I think it was 2016 when it was first announced, haven't you?
Oh, longer than that, Tony. The first inquiry into building a Hinkley C was in 1988, but it did take them until 2008 before they actually moved forward at all. And things got into gear here in 2011.
So what's this latest announcement? Apart from we've got the costs nearly doubling from the original announcement, which was, I think, 15 or 16 billion it was supposed to cost initially, they're now saying 35 billion. But that's kind of normal, isn't it? The doubling of the cost of something, especially when it's a white elephant. But what about the length of time it's going to cost to build the thing?
Okay, can we just hang on the money a bit? Because that's a 2015 price, and in today's money, it's reckoned to be £46 billion, which is an even bigger cost increase. So it is a huge amount of money, and EDF's problem with that is that the Chinese co-builder has put a stop to additional payment, if you like, and said, no, we committed for a certain amount, and that's all we're going to give you. And the latest we've seen is that EDF are likely to come cap in hand, or with something more stronger than that, demanding money from the British government and us to finish building it, let alone pay the extortionate price for the electricity once it's actually, if it ever generates.
Okay, so let's just get it clear about who's paying for this. This is EDF, which is the French nationalised
Government.
French government, and right. China. But China is now turning off the money tap.
That's correct. It was committed for a third of the original 18 billion estimate, and as having been turned away from other British potential nuclear builds, has said, well, if we're not getting in anywhere else, we're not stumping up any more money than we originally committed to for this. So they've turned the money tap off, and EDF is in deep financial trouble. There are questions from the union members of the EDF board as to why they seem to be pouring money down a bottomless pit in the UK when they have enough issues with their own nuclear reactors to absorb £100 billion. So what are they sinking more money in here? So they don't. It's not a bottomless money pit as far as EDF are concerned. And having people here in the government have said all along, oh, this is no bother because EDF are paying for it. And according to the Financial Times, it's just about to become a bother because EDF are getting cold feet about putting their own money anymore into the project and are going to be looking shortly for a government bailout.
Well, how far is it nearly built now?
No, nowhere near.
Because it sounds if EDF are pulling the plug on the funds and the Chinese, one does wonder whether one is going to be left with this kind of hulk of the power station that might have been, but down there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even by their own current estimates, it will be 2030/31 before there's the remotest prospect of any electricity being generated by Hinkley C. Too late to do any good for our immediate concerns about preventing climate change and keeping the temperature rise down below 2 degrees. So that in itself is an issue that Hinkley C won't solve. And it was interesting that last year EDF went to the government and said that we want to extend the last dates at which we can come online with Hinkley C and still get paid the colossal price per kilowatt hour that we're demanding, that was negotiated and is rising all the time, and they've had that extended to 2036.
Okay,
even by their own estimate, it could take as long as 2036, and whilst that would be, they'd not be happy with that, at least they'd be confident they'd get paid top dollar for 35 years after 2036.
Well, that is what they're doing in a way. They're betraying the fact that this isn't the last announcement of delays and cost overruns.
No, of course not. And there'll be more.
And how does this sort of price that we're paying for this electricity from Hinkley compare to, say, gas or coal?
Oh, it's heaps more. If people look at the National Grid website about how electricity is being generated and how much it's costing, it's really interesting because it's a spot price. So it changes every 5 or 10 minutes. And there are occasional peaks in demand, in very cold weather when there's much less wind and there's no solar or less solar. Occasionally, the spot price of electricity comes up to what Hinkley C's electricity will cost 24/7 for 35 years. Okay, but all the rest of the time, and especially at night time, they're virtually giving electricity away off the grid because the current nuclear power stations are generating 24/7 and it has to go somewhere. So it is amazingly cheap in the early hours of the morning. But that won't be the case for Hinkley C because they've got 24/7 promise on how much they're going to get paid, an exorbitant amount.
Yes, so this is the Energy Dashboard, I think, isn't it? Energydashboard.co.uk, a very interesting little website for nerds like you and I to keep an eye on what's happening.
I mean, the other staggering thing about that is when we're paying 30 pence per kilowatt hour, that translates to £300 per megawatt hour. And the actual cost during the day would rarely, if ever, go above 150 and is much more likely to be well under £100 per megawatt hour. So what we're paying is at least double and usually three or four or five times what it's actually costing the electricity companies at source.
Does Stop Hinkley go so far as to say what they think should happen instead of Hinkley? Because I remember for this is a few years ago now, sitting down with the environmental journalist Paul Mobbs and figuring out that for half the cost of Hinkley back in the round, that would have been about 2017, 2018, for about half the cost of Hinkley, you could have a tidal system in the Severn Estuary, in the Bristol Channel, generating as much power. I mean, I don't know if that's, you know, we're only amateurs sort of playing with figures from the Maygen tidal system up in Scotland. But, you know, there's certainly, there's a great potential for tidal, isn't there, around here?
Absolutely, especially in the Bristol Channel, you know, just out the window, all right, there's the second highest tidal rise and fall in the world. Utterly predictable, reliable, consistent. You know exactly what it's going to be, not just from day to day, but from year to year. So that's easy to predict how much electricity will be generated. That's the real joy of it. And it will become cheaper to do that once some prototypes that look like underwater wind turbines and other devices like that come on stream. But the government isn't putting any development money into that, because it's obsessed with new nuclear. It's just thrown 1.6 billion at the proposed new nuclear power station in Suffolk, Sizewell C, and that's just money down the drain. Because if they spent anything like that on improving the insulation of people's houses, even if you've got a gas-fired system, the fact that you're needing less heat from somewhere is a saving and a benefit to the environment, and is a lot cheaper than subsidising new nuclear. It benefits people with their current bills and is a great deal cheaper than throwing money at new nuclear power stations.
What about the accusation that this is ultimately a military thing, that the plutonium produced in the power stations after it's been reprocessed and taken out of the radioactive uranium, spent fuel rods, that's actually one of the main byproducts which the military love. They sort of rub their hands at every new bit of plutonium that's created in one of these stations. We've just heard a few weeks ago from the United States, they're threatening to start again to store their nuclear weapons here in, I think, at Lakenheath, and on British soil anyway. So this is another sort of side effect of this nuclear power that many of the Greens, who are now moving towards supporting nuclear for climate change reasons, seem to sidestep.
It's not something that I'm particularly familiar with. I've heard stuff, but it's not an area of expertise, Tony.
Martin?
Well, we know that the development of nuclear power was because they'd got nuclear weapons, and therefore they decided that they needed to do something else with it as well, because they were generating all of the plutonium and uranium. And of course, the Indians developed their nuclear weapons on the back of the Canadian peaceful reactors, which they got in. You know, they bought in Canadian companies to CANDU, I think it was, to create nuclear power stations in India, and it was that was quite clearly to do with their drive to get nuclear weapons. And of course, countries like Japan have nuclear power because they haven't got any fossil fuels. So you can see that the decisions about these things are not always made on financial terms. Because as has just been pointed out, the economics of it don't make sense. But of course, countries will want to have nuclear power for other reasons, which are not necessarily entirely directly economic.
And aren't there other smaller scale reactors that could be being built instead, Roy?
Yes. Small modular reactors. Yeah, it's a bit like nuclear fusion, Tony. Nuclear fusion, which is supposed to be, of course, the clean way to get power from the atom, that's probably 30 years away, and it always will be. Nobody has yet got a small modular reactor to work anywhere in the world, and I've seen no signs in the information that's come my way that we're anywhere near doing that. Rolls-Royce is so confident about the fact that theirs will work that they're demanding the full upfront cost of all the development and a contract for 100 of them, or a large number of them, before they'll do any more than just, you know, draw some designs. So, it's absurd. And who'd want one of those on their doorstep?
Well, you certainly can't bank on something like this that hasn't been properly tested. What about the liquid thorium reactors? I keep hearing about those as well.
Not an area of expertise.
No. So, I mean, if you're going to want something to replace good old coal-fired power stations, you're going to have to come up with something else, Roy, aren't you? What are you going to come up with instead of nuclear?
Well, offshore wind, onshore wind if people can be persuaded.
No, sorry, because when the wind doesn't blow, you haven't got any power. You need to make sure you've got that
power. You can store that electricity, okay? Storage batteries. Mr. Tesla has already got one of those up and running in South Australia. So it can be done and it can be put to there. And the same with solar. You can store that as well. I mean, that's what people in Africa who are out a long way from anywhere, haven't got any power connection, but with a photovoltaic cell unit, a solar panel and a battery, can get light at night even though the sun's gone down. And on a bigger scale, we can do that here.
This EGR, which they're building at Hinkley, is a European, I think, gas cooled reactor, am I right?
No, it's an EPR.
EPR.
It's pressurised water.
European pressurised water reactor. Thank you for correcting me. Right. How successful have they been where they've been fired up elsewhere?
No. I mean, you'd think on home turf, EDF would have been able to, you know, have a, you know, pristine, wonderful, 100%, you know, demonstrable model out there to show everybody. But the one in Normandy, Flamanville, that's still not working. And it is, I've lost count of how many years late it is, and massively over budget again. The one in Finland is supposed to be limping along, but that's even further behind where it was meant to be and massively over cost as well. The ones we don't hear much about are the ones in China, Taishan. The first of those started up with a big fanfare, but has since stopped down for over a year. And I'm not up to date with whether they've been able to restart that. The second one is supposed to be working, but it's not exactly a track record you'd be proud of. If you were trying to sell it, you'd struggle.
Yeah, well, they are. They're trying to sell it to the politicians and the public. So, apparently Taishan is just about going again. Looking at, I'm not sure if it's on full power or anything like that. Martin, what do you make of this return to belief in nuclear? It was something that happened in the 1950s and 60s here in Britain, and then it's like people fell out of love with nuclear, but now they're back in love with it again.
Well, I think what's politically, it was size. It was the Three Mile Island disaster in Chernobyl. These things. I mean, Chernobyl, for example, had a and Fukushima had a massive impact on politics in Germany because the Greens committed to getting rid of nuclear power straight away and all the rest of it. I mean, I did do a paper about the economics of nuclear power for the New Economics Foundation back in the 1980s because the Thatcher government wanted to privatise British nuclear fuels. Because like they wanted to privatise everything. And, of course, when the City of London looked at the books, they said, we're not touching that with a barge pole. So I think nuclear power has never really been, once you take into account things like getting rid of the waste and so on, it's never really been economically viable. But countries want to have nuclear power for geopolitical reasons. They want to develop nuclear weapons, and having nuclear power is a step to that, if that's what you want to do, and something that lots of countries do. And the other thing is, if you can't rely on the oil or gas supply from somebody else that's got a hold on you, you can imagine the kind of thinking going on at the moment. We're going to war with Russia, and we've got to be independent of their gas and oil and all the rest of it. But a lot of it is just inertia. It's just that the nuclear industry is very good at lobbying. And then you get the sunk costs. I mean, the EDF in the US, in France, I mean, they've developed a huge stable of nuclear reactors and so on, and they could probably generate more nuclear electricity than anybody else. And once you've done that, even if you're losing money, you're stuck with it, because that's the pattern. You know, you're path dependent on the previous decisions you've taken. But I mean, and I think, you know, China and Russia, for example, are going out pushing nuclear power in the developing world. But China and Russia don't entirely have market economies. So I would argue if you have a proper, you know, properly functioning market economy, nuclear power just isn't attractive.
There is this article in the Times this week, Roy, about, it says, it's Alistair Osborne writing, saying the growing amount of wasted money is a radioactive prospect. He's saying that this is basically going to come and bite us on the bum in the years to come. And it's Rishi Sunak's determination to press ahead with these mammoth investments in new nuclear reactors, whatever the cost, might not prove to be the best solution, he says. You know, of course, by the time it comes to the end of the year, it's almost certain that Sunak is going to be history anyway. So what is the future for nuclear, do you think?
Bleak, in a word. I think they will struggle to complete the construction of Hinkley C, and it will take a lot of time to get it, if they can get it to work, and there's no guarantee that that's going to happen. So it's all happening too late to make the impact they want. They talk about Hinkley providing the electricity for 7% of people's houses, which would be a mammoth number. If you do proper insulation for a kickoff, that reduces demand by 7%. So that just wipes out part of the rationale for building Hinkley. Sizewell, apart from the massive local resistance to building in Suffolk, a second new nuclear power station, they have a huge problem with water supply. It was only ever the Chinese that were interested in a new site at Bradwell in Essex. And the other ones that have popped their heads up, Wilfer in Wales, I think it's Hitachi, wasn't it, that walked away from that because they needed a deal that would make it pay, and they couldn't get that. And as I've dismissed small modular reactors already, I think the prospect of a – well, let me put it this way, Tony. The solar panels on my roof are currently producing more electricity than any nuclear output in Somerset. And I expect that to continue to be the case for probably 10 more years at least.
Well, I agree. And then before he died, I had a very interesting chat with John Large, the nuclear engineer who worked for the Fire Brigades Union and other people, and he was absolutely convinced that Hinkley would never be completed. He said all you need to do is to look at the EDF's other commitments. Yeah. The fact of the matter is this is really at the bottom of the line for them. And for the Chinese to pull out financially, saying we're not going to be putting any more money into this, at least you see they are saying, aren't they saying effectively, Roy, look, we're not throwing good money after bad.
Exactly. And that is their problem, that they spent a lot of money on putting a steel structure up and putting a lid on it. Well, bully for them. But there's the 80-20 rule, all right, that the first 80% of what they do will cost 20% of whatever the budget turns out to be. But the last 20% will cost 80% of the bill and take 80% of the time. And that's the jam they're in. That's what they found at Crossrail. Just doing those last things cost them a huge amount on the budget they had to do that, the train across London, and an inordinate amount of time extra to what they'd allowed for in the first place.
Sounds like one of those old cartoons we used to watch as kids, that the closer you get to the end of the plank, the slower you go. And actually, you never really get into the end of the plank. So anyway, look, Roy, how do people follow, keep an eye on Stop Hinkley and what you guys are up to?
Right, we have a Facebook page, the Stop Hinkley page, where we have followers who are, you know, contributing, and we're putting stuff on that. We obviously have a website, stophinkley.org, and, well, now and again, people like your very good self interview, and we're happy to talk to any media anytime who've got an interest in this topic, this hopefully never too hot topic, but something that should be more at the forefront of people's minds, really, because the amount of money it will cost them in the long run doesn't really bear thinking about.
No, and us as consumers buying electricity.
Yes, yeah. Sorry, that's what I meant. I meant us as consumers. Mm. Yeah.
Thanks, Roy. Martin, we have a white elephant, effectively, don't we? And what's your thoughts about whether this is ever going to be finished?
Well, I tend to concur with everybody else who are the experts saying it won't be, and it doesn't sound as if it will be. I was reading about this week that somebody on the board of EDF resigned over this because he's saying this is stupid. We've got enough problems managing our existing stock in France. And I think that's probably, eventually things like this will not get done.
And
that's
so
what will happen. It'll just be a waste of time.
Another nuclear expert I spoke to about this, Dr. Chris Busby, and isn't it lovely to speak to an expert that isn't in the pay of the industry? Dr. Chris Busby, his thoughts about this, Martin, were that actually this has nothing to do with building any kind of nuclear power station that's ever going to connect up to a grid. It's all about the construction contract. That's where these people are going to make their money, and they've already made it. And once they've got close to this point that Roy was talking about there, where suddenly the costs have to go up for them to make that sort of get over the hump to finish the thing, they're off.
Yeah, but I mean, somebody ultimately has to pay the price. And obviously, at the moment, what Nils Prattley in The Guardian was saying is it's EDF who looks as if they're on the hook here, and that the board made a mistake in actually agreeing to go into this project. Now, obviously, I haven't looked into the.
But it's like HS2, isn't it? It's rather like, very like HS2. At some point, the people responsible for it say, well, look, there's no point in even trying to finish this because it's going to cost way, way, way too much. We're never going to recoup our investment.
Well, that's right. And, of course, people have been subcontracted to build it will get their money and walk away, won't they, because they didn't take any of the risk. They're just doing – they tell, you know, build us a concrete something over here, and that's what they do. And they get their money and they go away. And, of course, those contractors then, of course, may be lobbying for the – you know, continuation of the project, because for them it's a gravy train.
But it's a wonderful country. It's a wonderful government. Actually, I do think it's a wonderful country. Wonderful people, an appalling government. But the government is now saying, in the guise of the Ministry of Defence, that they might have to conscript us to go and fight the Russians. What do you make of this?
Well, it was that retired general who made the remarks in the Telegraph, wasn't it? And then the government itself then immediately poo-pooed that and said, we've got no plans for conscription at all. But I do find it rather amusing to watch the Tory establishment in this country. On one side of their mouth, they're saying we're going to have tax cuts and we're all going to have a great time and we're all going to go on holiday. And the other side of their mouth, and we're going to go to war with Russia and we need conscription and rationing. Doesn't quite add up, does it?
Are the Russians likely to invade us? This is a topic which came up, by the way, Sergei Lavrov's recent press conference. Do you think that's likely to happen? What he said was, which I found fascinating, was that actually there's a secret agreement, which the Russians have got hold of somehow, between Britain and Ukraine, which is a mutual defence agreement. So that if the Russians invade Ukraine, which they've done, the British will come to their defence. And if and but of course, if the Russians invade Britain, Ukraine will come to our defence.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of delusions going on at that level in the British foreign policy establishment. I mean, this general was a, you know, he was the commander of the army. I believe he was passed over to become head of the armed forces. I mean, the idea of Britain facing off with Russia is laughable. I mean, Marchanov, who's a blog I read all the time, it's called Reminiscences of the Future, he's a Russian naval officer. He lives in the US now. The British are simply incapable of putting an army into the field that would do anything to the Russians at all, which is why we concentrate so much on terrorism and psychological warfare, because we can't really do anything else.
Well, let's have a listen to... Do you know the name of the guy that popped up on Talk TV this week? I couldn't quite believe it. His name is Colonel Simon Diggins. So, obviously, he's a defensive colonel in his foxhole, and he'll be sitting there along with all the conscripts should the Russians invade Britain.
Firstly, for a while now, there's been voices raised showing real concern over our lack of preparedness, our lack of resilience, and most recently, over really very abysmal recruiting and retention figures. I mean, the government's plan is to have us reduced formally by 2025 to 72,000 soldiers in the field. And that's well below the lowest figure we've ever been since the Napoleonic Wars. But the sad reality of that is, as our current recruiting retention figures continue, we're actually going to be about 70,000. So we're going to be below even that abysmally low figure. And that trend's been at the case for nearly 10 years. So there's a real issue now about that, plus a recognition that we live in a very dangerous world. And I think the warnings from the Swedish Prime Minister, who was also the Estonian Prime Minister, that actually within 3 to 5 years, Russia could be in a place where they could do us real harm, is absolutely there. You know, we need to get to a place now where, in a way, it hasn't existed for a generation. Defence spending and how we organise our armed forces has actually got to become a national issue. It's been very largely ignored by both political parties now for nearly 30 years.
Yeah. Sir Patrick Sanders, Chief of General Staff at the Army, the Army Chief, he says we're at our 1937 moment, which is really chilling. People will make jokes that I was there, but I do know that in 1937, most people in Britain didn't really think it would actually happen. 1939, all-out World War. Is Sir Patrick Sanders right? Are we at our 1937 moment? Is the prospect of all-out global war real and imminent?
I think it's always a possibility. We've been looking at over the last few weeks the possibility of a regional escalation in the Middle East as a result of the Israel-Hamas fighting and the way it spread from there. And that's always a possibility. There's also what we're dealing with Russia. It's a country that's not entirely behaving in a completely rational fashion. You have Putin and you have people around Putin who are not just kind of old-fashioned Russian imperialists, but they seem to have a sort of a messianic belief that Russia has a divine right to rule vast swathes of Eastern Europe. You know, they see this, they call it their civilizational mission. You know, they've got this kind of belief inside them that that's there. When you're dealing with people like that, you need to have the forces and the resilience to oppose them. And that's more than just having a shot window of some good soldiers, great people, and the bare minimum to get us through a minor counterinsurgency somewhere. We're looking at a different scale of warfare, and that threat exists. Putin, post-Ukraine, might well try and try something in the Baltics. We need to be prepared for that.
Well, I think that's just delusionary. If you think about it, the idea that Britain has got to be prepared to fight Russia is absurd. Russia is a superpower. Russia is a much bigger economy than Britain. Their army is always going to be far bigger than anything we're going to be able to put together. And even if we decided we were going to create an army to fight the Russians from scratch tomorrow, it would be too late because the Russians are already winning the war we're in, which Britain is already fighting. British special forces are definitely operating inside the Ukraine and inside Russia. And a lot of the terrorist attacks inside Russia have been orchestrated by British special forces.
Martin,
in
MI6. I know you're a very big Russophile, but could it not be that in Ukraine, the Putin is testing out the West? He's seeing what our reaction is going to be. That's the next point that Colonel Simon Diggins put about this potential need to start conscription here in Britain.
Well, I mean, is it a good idea then that Erdogan has now agreed to let Sweden join NATO? NATO is expanding. The areas in which Putin could dip his toe in and find there has to be some sort of retribution has suddenly got a lot larger.
It has, and we hope that Finland will join as well. But Putin, again, said, we're doing it, so we're not dealing with a completely irrational actor. He will look at that and see, well, can I test them? Yeah, are we really going to say that Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, the Suwalki Gap, which is the gap between Lithuania and Poland, yeah, are, if you like, are worth the bones of a British grenadier? That old line from Bismarck in looking back to that issue. Yeah, and we need to make sure that he understands that our front line of defence are those NATO countries, that we are real about what we're going to say, and we will defend them. And we need to have something more to say than the shop window. We have very little debt. We have almost no resilience. And faced with that, he will think, maybe I can take a chance on that. We need to make sure he understands that if he does decide to take a chance on that, he will lose. And that needs more than we've got at the moment.
I mean, I don't like calling for the government to spend lots of our tax pounds, but our armed forces are so denuded. You know, there's 73,000 of them, wouldn't even fill a football ground to defend a nation of 68 million people. Does not the government have to invest pretty speedily in recruiting more people to defend this country, more armed forces? We've got to do something, haven't we?
Totally agree with you. The figures we're talking about, you know, we're hovering around 2.1-2.2% of our GDP. Rishi Sunak talks about spending 2.5%. When circumstances permit. Well, by that basis, circumstances are never going to permit. For sensible defence economic analysts, so we need to be spending about a minimum of 3% of our GDP on defence. You know, and here's the call. Yeah, let's have 3% now. That's the figure we need. That needs to be sustained for a significant number of years in order to get us something up to the same place we're at. I'll give you one comparison here, if I may, which is what Russia's now spending. Now, they're in the middle of a war, but they're currently spending about 6% of their GDP on defence, or one third of all their government expenditure. That's the threat. That's the opposition. That's what they're doing now, and they will keep going. That's why we need to up our game massively.
I'm not sure 16% is a third. In fact, I know it's not. It's about half of a third. But anyway, I suppose, you know, obviously there may be some other interpretation of those figures that he's giving there. Martin, what about conscription? It's not really going to happen, is it? Didn't they sort of run this whole idea of national service and conscription out every once in a while, don't they?
Well, they used to run it out in the 60s because it was a thing in the 50s. I mean, my father did national service in the 1950s, involved in the Suez Crisis in the RAF. And, of course, in those days, people expected that they were going to be conscripted. And can I remind the general and the other officer that the top rate of tax in this country in the 1950s was 96%. 95%. And if they want a wartime economy, that means that Rishi Sunak has got to hand over all of his wealth. We've got to bring in inheritance taxes because the poor can't pay for it. It's only the wealthy that can pay for that sort of stuff. This is what Putin's doing. He's taxing the oligarchy. They've all been driven out of the West and had to take their money back to Russia. And he's using it to, he uses his nationalized arms industry to produce tanks, hypersonic missiles, drones, etc. Now, the fact is the war between NATO and Russia has already started. The Russians haven't got an objective of taking over the Baltic states. They don't even want the west of the Ukraine, which is frankly a basket case. They've taken the best bits of the Ukraine, where all the industry is, and where the people speak Russian, and that they intend to keep. But they are not going to invade the rest of the Ukraine or any of the countries in Eastern Europe, because they're poor. There's nothing there for them to take. They're not interested in any of that. We have messed up our relationship with the Russians so badly over the last 30 years that we're now in a position where the Russians could invade the West. They could wipe out the Baltic states in one go. Can you imagine how long it would take the Russian army to overrun the Baltic states? They're tiny little countries, much smaller than Wales,
okay,
completely surrounded by Russia.
The idea that people like Sunak and Gaet get taxed is pie in the sky, isn't it?
That's right. So in other words, what are they talking about?
Oxfam released a report at the World Economic Forum. Henry Ridgewell, to be precise, that hundreds of world's leaders and chief executives at the Swiss ski resort of Davos for last week's five-day meeting of the World Economic Forum. Oxfam is warning of a growing gulf of inequality fueled by corporate power. The world's richest five men have more than doubled their fortune this decade since 2020. We're only 4 years in, aren't we? And nearly 5 billion people have been made poorer. At current rates, the world will see its first trillionaire within a decade, whilst it would take over two centuries to end poverty, said Nabil Ahmed of America, they're calling it a decade of division. So what's happening is those in power are just abusing that power to make us poor and them rich.
Yes, and of course this has military implications. So the military-industrial complex in the West is essentially a way of making expensive weaponry, which is inferior, as long as profit is made. So they couldn't actually increase the amount of shells they're producing, for example, because private companies will only produce for a profit. The Russians have got a tremendous advantage in that their arms industries were owned by the government. Now, the problem for armchair generals, which is what effectively they are, is that...
Well, so are we.
Well, indeed, but so are they, as that's what the Russians would say, is that we're just closing down our last steel plant in Britain. So how are we going to have a wartime economy to fight the Russians? It's ludicrous. We are a small Western European country. We do not need a massive arms industry to fight the Russians. It's absurd. We don't need one to aggress against Yemen either. But we're doing it. And, of course, the cost for that will be enormous. The only way we could try and fight the Russians is to nationalise most of the industry, massively increase taxes on the wealthy, and militarise society. So conscription would have to mean that posh kids got conscripted as well as poor kids. That's what conscription means. You do your 2 years national service. And, of course, national service doesn't actually lead to having very effective armed forces, because people who just do 2 years are not really that good at the job. What the Russians have done is they've actually built up a non-conscript armed forces, and because of what's the general feeling in Russia about the Ukraine, they've been able to massively increase the numbers of people who want to come forward and fight. That is because they care about it. The fact is that most people in Britain do not care about who controls various towns and cities in the Ukraine. They don't. And they're certainly not prepared to pay taxes for it, and they're certainly not prepared to die for it, because they don't care about it. The Russians do. It's their doorstep. It's not ours.
We're going to hear from Russia speaking about this ridiculous agreement between the British and the Ukrainians. Let's have a listen to that now. This is an annual press conference that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and we're going to be hearing in a minute the Russian ambassador to the UK, Andrei Kelin, speaking too, in English this time. This one is translated, though. This is Sergei Lavrov answering questions at his annual press conference last week. And I just like to play this because although it's extremely important to hear from the Russians, we never do hear, it seems, that they're banned from places like Channel 4 and the BBC.
The question was about the agreement between Kiev and London, the security agreement. How does it fit into the future settlement? Well, this is not something new. Some years ago, when there were clashes about admitting Ukraine into NATO, the EU and some other countries, they were not that happy. Not everyone was happy, and they understood, some of them, that it would be yet another irresponsible, risky step from the point of view of European security. So it's just kind of a half-baked product. Namely, this idea of concluding bilateral agreements with certain Western countries. I've heard about the contents of the document agreed upon by Zelensky and Sunak, and judging by that document, I do not see any legally binding agreements apart from Ukraine's obligation to defend the British Isles should an invasion be mounted against the UK. Well, somewhat funny, somewhat comedic, maybe it's a continuation of Neighborhood 95, maybe the name has been changed of this band of comedians. But be that as it may, these agreements do not change our goals, and this has recently been confirmed by President Putin in our special military operation. We're going to achieve our goals, doing that persistently and consistently. the goals will be achieved. From time to time, the West is sending some signals, then these signals are taken back, as it were. We are taking these signals philosophically. Our president has pointed out on numerous occasions that Russia is not refusing to talk. He said that back in 2022, when at the behest of Boris Johnson and other Anglo-Saxons, Kyiv was forbidden from concluding a settlement agreement with Russia. It happened in April 2022. This story is well known now. And speaking about this subject back in 2022, our president pointed out that Russia did not refuse to talk, but he said that everyone else needs to understand that if they refuse talks, then the longer this would drag on and the more difficult it would be. And we see this prophecy has now come to pass. There are no hopes right now that Russia is going to be somehow defeated. This has been pointed out on multiple occasions. Those who have not learned their history and geography, you know, there are many people like that in the West, they can fantasize about that. They can write yet another scenario for this neighborhood 95, but it's going to have no bearing on life.
So that's, in translation, Sergei Lavrov, Russian foreign minister, speaking, talking about the British as clowns having this mutual defence agreement with Ukraine. Well, I must admit, if the Russians were to invade Scotland, for example, I can't imagine thousands of Ukrainian troops coming over here and leaving their own home front unprotected.
No, and I can't imagine them joining us with in the invasion of Yemen with the Americans either. But that's where we're going. I mean, we're going into war right now this minute. So it's and it's already happening. And there's no way that the British armed forces can be increased in any way, shape, or form on the timescale we're talking about, which is in the next 18 months. So in other words, well, war's already started. Started by the West, actually. Blaming Putin for all of this is absolutely specious. It's the West that carried out the coup in 2014. It's a NATO death squad that killed the people in the Maidan Square. The shooting down of the MH17 plane was carried out by a plane from Kiev. And all of these people have been working closely with MI6 all the time. Britain is very much involved in what you might call terrorism and psychological warfare. But of course, when it comes to actual fighting, the British Challenger tanks, for example, have just been whacked off the battlefield in the Ukraine by the superior publicly produced Russian kit, unlike our privately produced junk.
The Russian ambassador, Andrei Kelin, he spoke earlier this week. And it's just, I mean, I don't hear these people. I want to hear from them. What do they think about Gaza? What do they think about what's going on in the Middle East? And here he talks specifically about the genocide in Gaza.
We, of course, detest any terrorist activity. And it happened on the 7th of October. But on the other hand, we do not support at all what's going in Gaza right now by Israelis. First of all, I should say that our position is sort of balanced in a way that we do have around 14% of population, of Russian population in Israel, and we have a similar, around 14% of Muslims in Russia. So we need to see balance in both of these baskets. But we do not support at all. We appeal that violence should stop in Gaza. Violence should stop in Gaza, not as opposed, but for all, for forever. And negotiations should take place in order to arrange two-state solution over there. Like that. You cannot contain the Palestinians like that forever. You need to give them a state solution. That is, this is what is most important. And this is what Israel doesn't want to do, neither the United States. I'm sure, although in words they are supporting this idea, but in deeds they would like that Palestinian is a non-existent factor over there.
He's making, this is Andrei Kelin, the Russian ambassador to Britain, speaking earlier this week. He's saying in very clear terms there, look, the British are saying, and the Americans are saying that they want a Palestinian state. In reality, they want them gone.
Well, the Israelis, Netanyahu has just said, well, we're not having one. So the sort of liberal politicians in the West, the Keir Starmers, Joe Biden, saying, yes, but there will be a two-state solution in the end. There won't. because Netanyahu has ruled it out. The Russians are in a bind about this because they would like a two-state solution because they don't really want any more trouble. The trouble is, from everybody's point of view, it's all gone too far now, and the situation is slipping out of anybody's control.
If people in Gaza had their own state, then Hamas wouldn't be a terror group. It would be their army, wouldn't it?
Well, it is. That is effectively what they are, despite what everybody else is saying.
And this is part of this war on terror, and this misuse of the word terrorism is the idea if you can deprive somebody of a state, then everything they do to fight back is terrorism. But the thing is, under international law, that's not the case.
That is quite right, Tony, and obviously the International Court of Justice has been ruling on this very day. I mean, the Israeli Defense Forces, if we can call them that, the Israeli Occupation Forces, grew directly out of the paramilitaries which carried out massacres of Palestinians to establish the Israeli state in 1948. They killed thousands of people, and they were completely upfront about what they were doing, and they weren't punished in any way, shape or form. The people that did that became the leaders of the new state of Israel. And Hamas is exactly the same. There is no difference in the tactics adopted by the two sides. So the idea that one lot are terrorists and the other lot are not is rubbish. They are all at war with each other, and sadly, in wars, civilians often are deliberately targeted by both sides. I'm not saying that Hamas have actually issued a statement saying what they think happened on October the 7th, saying that although some excesses occurred, that's what they're saying, we didn't go out there to try and kill civilians, we wanted civilian hostages, or, you know, to trade, and we wanted to kill Israeli soldiers. And that's what they were trying to do. And of course, in the Muslim world, Hamas are regarded as a military organisation and certainly not as a terrorist organisation. They've been called a terrorist organisation in Britain, so if you say you're in support of them, you're a terrorist. But they are the elected government of Palestine. They won the election in 2006.
In a way, I mean, this proscribing of groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, who else is there? The Houthis now, apparently, yeah. Which is the government of Yemen, excuse me. The idea is that anybody that supports them in Britain or even says that they're okay could be potentially be jailed or at least arrested for just saying that they're okay, because it would be very interesting. I always thought if this came to court, Tony Greenstein was arrested recently for talking about saying he supported Hamas against the Israeli Defense Force, and he was then let go. But if that sort of thing was to come to court, he'd have a pretty strong case, wouldn't he? Saying, well, actually, it's ridiculous this proscribing of this group, because it is the legitimate government, and they have it's part of the legitimate government of that country, and these people do have a right to self-defense under international law. So he would be showing up the absurdity of calling these organisations, proscribing them as terrorist.
Well, that's right. And of course, the old Irish joke used to go, how do you know which ones are the terrorists in any situation? And the answer is, they're the ones with the little bombs. Because if you've got big bombs, you can't be a terrorist. You are obviously a state. And of course, the Israeli state was created by terrorists. The people in charge of it were terrorists. The British army, the British certainly regarded them as terrorists when they were killing police officers, soldiers and civilians. But of course, they were rewarded. You could argue that the current Israeli state is a terrorist state, and therefore it should be under sanctions, and the people who run it should be fearing the long arm of the law, and a return to Nuremberg, and possibly a hangman's rope. I mean, if you're going to say that you can't say you support somebody and they're terrorists, then you've got to actually justify that, and then there is no justification for it. Hamas are the elected government of Palestine. They are. They just are. Just as the Israeli government is the elected government of Israel. I would say that because they're so vile and evil, we shouldn't recognise them. But the same would be true of, you know, if you're going to start throwing stones, make sure you're not in a glass house.
Well, we'll be talking about the International Court of Justice and Gaza after the break. But finally, Martin, a plane was brought down this week over in Russia, which was carrying 65 or so prisoners of war from the Ukraine, shot down by the Ukrainians. And yet the Zelensky, of course, is saying this is the Russians' fault.
Well, the Russians are saying, everybody admits that it was an American Patriot missile that took the plane down. Don't forget some while ago, if you remember, all of the Azovstal people that were being held by the Russians, the Ukrainians put a missile onto the camp where they were being held and killed a load of them because they didn't want them, you know, because they wanted to blame the Russians for killing them. The Ukrainians have killed a lot of their own people. They have, you know, I've seen loads of evidence that they've got barrier squads following their troops into action. So if anybody turns around, they get killed. They get shot up by their own side. And of course, within the Ukraine itself, loads of people have been disappeared, tortured, and removed from, you know, and basically, you know, killed off. All of which we never hear in our media. It's the evil Russians, the evil Putin, the glorious Zelensky, the wonderful Israelis who are just defending themselves.
Well, let's
just
have a listen to an Al Jazeera report on that plane crash now, brought down by an American missile fired by the Ukrainians, killing 65 of their own soldiers.
This was the moment a Russian military transport plane crashed to the ground, prompting conflicting claims and counterclaims about what and who was on board. Russian officials say the Ilyushin 76, similar to this one, was transporting 65 Ukrainian prisoners of war for a prisoner exchange. They claim anti-aircraft missiles were detected being launched from the Ukrainian side of the border.
On the morning of January 24, Moscow time, a terrorist act was committed, as a result of which, in the area of the Belgorod region, a Russian transport aircraft was shot down, which was carrying out a flight to transport 65 military personnel of the armed forces of Ukraine from the Moscow region to Belgorod, who were accompanied by three Russian officers and a crew of six people. They all died.
The claims were immediately treated with deep suspicion by Ukraine, that accuses Russia of conducting long-standing disinformation campaigns.
It is obvious that the Russians are playing with the lives of Ukrainian prisoners, with the feelings of their relatives, and with the emotions of our society. It is necessary to establish all clear facts, as much as possible, given that the plane crash happened on Russian territory beyond our control. Facts is the key word now.
Officially, Ukraine says it has no evidence of its prisoners of war being on the plane, but a statement by military intelligence has hinted that if they were on board, Russia was responsible for their safety, blaming Moscow for not informing Kyiv of transport arrangements for the prisoner swap and for flying POWs so close to an active war zone. Establishing the truth has been made harder by the secrecy that surrounds the highly sensitive exchanges of Russian and Ukrainian prisoners. This was the last prisoner swap carried out at New Year. Even Russia's list of the Ukrainian POWs they say were on the plane is being disputed, with a number of social media posts questioning the veracity of some of the names. Rob McBride, Al Jazeera, Kyiv.
I think the idea from the Ukrainian side is just to always throw doubt over everything. Right? Well, actually, maybe they were another. The Russians are just lying. Oh, that name, we don't recognise that name. Oh, well, that may be part of a mercenary group, not the official army. So they're always good at throwing doubt over this. But I mean, it does seem as if it is feasible that the Russians flew this aircraft fairly close to the border, knowing that if the Ukrainians shot it down, they'd be killing mostly their own people.
Well, I think nobody seems to be suggesting that the Russians shot down their own plane, although, of course, they're still suggesting that they blew up their own Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Well, it may just be an accident. You know, the plane's flying, it's a Russian plane, so the air defence on the Ukrainian side just decides to target it. But a transport plane like that isn't a threat to you, is it? It's a transport plane.
No, but they just think, oh, look, here's something, let's just shoot it, because we can.
Yes, and therefore it may be just a concatenation of errors. If it was done deliberately, it's more likely done by the Ukrainian side, because they have got the advice from MI6 and all the other Western intelligence agencies about the use of false flag operations, which they've been doing for years. And people who are regular listeners to this show will know that NATO carries out false flag operations. For example, the shooting down of MH17, which I mentioned earlier. BBC Russia interviewed people on the ground soon after the event, and they said they'd seen it shot down by a plane from Kiev. and this was not an accident, and the blaming of Russia was not an accident. The media immediately launched into, you know, this is Putin's missile and so on and so forth. This kind of intelligence operation is the bread and butter of NATO intelligence services. Now, I'm not saying that the Russians don't also have their own fast and loose tactics as well, but on the other hand, they've generally gone for the policy of what we say you can take to the bank. We don't make stuff up. Now, it's a tragedy, but it's been a huge tragedy for a long time now. Some more people are dead. But, of course, the real problem is that there shouldn't have been a war in the first place, as was pointed out by Lavrov. There was a deal on the table to settle all this in April 2022, and the glorious blondie one, Boris Johnson, scuppered it. Arestovich, who used to be in with Zelensky, he is now in New York, and he is emerging as a potential challenger to Zelensky. And he is basically saying, I signed that deal and we could have done it. And therefore, he's now becoming a kind of critic of the Zelensky regime.
You better watch himself when he crosses the road.
Well, I think that's a problem for him, yeah. He's got to think about it.
Maybe he should think about some other country. Anyway, we'll be having our break now. We'll be talking about the International Court of Justice decision announced today after some music. But first, Patrizia Opulenza's poem of the week, The Whores of War. General Sanders, warmonger, shrew, before he leaves, has much to do. Conscription talk is now his bag. A Davos face-off seems would brag. Woke rules now seen where we look. Females first will try to hook. A place in war, then gender games. The they, the them, AZ's insane. Identify as whatever you will, boots on ground, don't care who's killed, no mention made of damage done to climate change, from wars and bombs. Land army cry to fight, what for? Death, destruction, made up wars, conscription push for military ills, dead man's boots this general fills. Perhaps a rule we now should make, those for war should all partake, front line all go. Tobias, too, to take their chance, like soldiers do, to fight the fight, if this they crave. Instead of pushing sons in graves, will refugees now all be tricked to fight in wars, the new conscripts? Black hole in pensions pot is true. War plans our lives to rid of you. The jabs will grab more lives, a fact. So many ways our lives attack, coerce young folks to take last breath on battlegrounds all steeped in death. Enlist each voice for blood and gore. Call up and draft all whores of war.
the 49th chapter of the prophecy of Isaiah. Thus says the Lord, the Redeemer of Israel and his Holy One, to one deeply despised, abhorred by the nations, the slave of rulers, kings shall see and stand up, princes, and they shall prostrate themselves because of the Lord who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel, who has chosen you. Thus says the Lord, in a time of favour I have answered you. On a day of salvation I have helped you. I have kept you and given you as a covenant to the people, to establish the land, to apportion the desolate heritages, saying to the prisoners, come out. To those who are in darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed along the ways, on all the bare heights shall their pasture. They shall not hunger or thirst, neither scorching wind nor sun shall strike them down. For he who has pity on them will lead them, and by springs of water will guide them. And I will turn all my mountains into a road, and my highways shall be raised up. Lo, these shall come from far away, and lo, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Cyrene. Sing for joy, O heavens, and exalt, O earth. Break forth, O mountains, into singing. For the Lord has comforted his people and will have compassion on his suffering ones. Here ends the first lesson.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to hear it in your pod. You'll owe nothing and be happy. Ain't got no cash, ain't got no car, but 24 booster shots in your arm. Oh, nothing. Be happy. You can't even buy shit in the store because of your low social credit score. Oh, nothing. Happy. You will own nothing and be happy. Be happy and eat some bugs.
Damn, it feels good to be a Schwarbler. A real Schwarbler always keen to get his facts right.
Snickers for Linkshander.
Caucasian time. Are you a drug dealer? And if so, why?
Question. Gerald Hawksworth, White Man's Gazette. Why are our prisons so overpopulated with black men?
Excuse me, right here.
Excuse me, yes. Peter Clannings, the White Street Journal. Why is it that most violent crimes are committed by black American males?
Please answer the question.
I'm just a young black man trying to be paid so I could be like the other man and have it made. Life in the city is rough. Welfare don't pay enough. A good job for the young black man is a buffer. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. I only rob the rich to feed my family, and now they call me a menace to society.
Yes, I'm a menace to society.
Yes, I'm a menace to society. Cause I'm a menace to society.
Yes, I'm a menace to society.
Cause I'm a menace to society.
Yes,
good job in a place like Steel Mill sounds good, but I make more money from my neighborhood, and my neighborhood keeps both pockets fat, so I keep going back. That's where the money's at. Black from hell, that's who I am and where I've been. Task force rolls by, I grin. Then I commenced to collecting my mail, hoping and praying not to end up in a jail cell. Mama's whole life is depending on me, cause it's hard to survive on AFDC. Food stamps, free milk and cheese. When I think about it, hit another liquor store and yell freeze. Everybody on the floor. Then I empty the cash drawer and run for the front door. This is the reason why, you see, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm called a menace to society. I'm a menace to society.
Furthermore, I feel the needs of the black community has yet to be met. Our federal government and its corporate allies have the means necessary to put an end to this political oppression, which continues to keep the African American struggling for survival.
The streets are unsafe. With a brother like me, see, I take your car, VCR, and your TV. I drive away singing songs on your radio. My conscience starts talking to me, saying way to go. Cause once again, my family could be fed, the rent is paid. So we can rest ahead, I look forward to a brighter day. All I can do is pray and hope and pray. Task force is brutal, and I'm angry. The DA sees a brother like me and wants to hang me. Run across a brother like me and can't hack and jack a young punk quick. For a Raiders jacket, I run the streets just to get my grit on, so my family can have some decent furniture to sit on. So don't try to tell me how to be, cause I'm a just be me, signed menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. Yes, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society.
Grave, result of a drive-by. I hate it cause I know it makes my mother cry. Her whole life is a nervous wreck, and I'm a social reject trying to get a paycheck. Society is giving birth to a fool like me. I'm a T-H-R-E-A-T, so they label me lazy. They say I'm uneducated, violent and crazy, but I'm a young black man trying to be paid so I can be like the other man that haven't made. Life in the city is rough. Welfare don't quite pay enough. A job for the young black man is a cover. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. They say I'm a menace to society, but society's a menace to me. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. They say I'm a menace to society. Society's a menace to me.
That's good old Chili B there in 19, I think 96, redone of course to try and get the copyright, push the copyright back and get in 2004. There was actually a film called Menace to Society as well. Chili B, those were the days. That's what they call real rap. So not the sort of nonsense that they churn out on all the commercial and the BBC stations all the time. And it's good to hear. I first heard that one on the John Peel show. It would have been back in 96, I imagine. Before that, we had a rather peculiar song about Klaus Schwab. I'm not sure quite what the origin of that is, but I will put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, found it on YouTube. Before that, we had the Glory, Glory, Hallelujah. Lay My Burden Down. I'm not even sure who that's by, but lovely song it was too. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So the announcement today at the International Criminal Court, Martin, is a
not
sort
the
of
international criminal.
Sorry, the International Court of Justice. You're quite right. Sometimes referred to as the World Court or the UN Court. Because it does have force of law from the United Nations rather than from some sort of little thing that NATO set up like the International Criminal Court was. It's a bit of a fudge, isn't it? So they're not demanding a ceasefire. They're calling for a ceasefire, but they most definitely are saying that it's a genocide.
Well, I haven't read the whole thing, Tony, and I believe we're going to hear some of the, we're going to have some clips of the actual judgment. So, I think they're fudging, aren't they? I think that's the impression I get. They're trying to please the South Africans and the other countries which have brought this case, and they're also trying to stay on the right side of the Americans, the Brits and the Israelis, who are obviously vehemently opposed to it. So, you know, it's what you might expect, because the court presumably has got a balance of powers within it, you know, judges from various different countries.
BBC are saying that the International Court of Justice, well, they have a majority decision, which I think is something like 15 to 1 or 15 to 2 or something, judges. So the BBC is reporting the International Court of Justice says Israel must prevent genocide in Gaza. Well, asking them to prevent it is a bit pointless if it's already going on, seems to me.
Yes. I mean, I think they do demand a ceasefire, or at least I think that's what I picked up from what I read earlier. And of course, that is the demand of most countries. The only countries opposed to a ceasefire are Israel itself, the United States, and Britain. Everybody else, virtually, has said, look, there's got to be a ceasefire.
Kenneth Roth in The Guardian today, or I suppose it'll be in tomorrow's printed paper, the ICJ ruling is a repudiation of Israel and its Western backers. Will Israel's allies urge them to comply with the court's ruling? It would do enormous damage to the rules-based order if they make an exception for Israel. Of course, this is nothing new to the West, is it? We had an illegal war in Iraq, didn't we?
Yes, and of course the intervention in Yugoslavia and Libya, neither of which were justified by UN resolutions and so on. So the rest of the world is getting wise to this. I mean, you know, because this has been a truly testing set of circumstances which should force the rest of the world to confront how bankrupt, morally bankrupt, the West is, and of course militarily and politically as well.
I think it's quite a good idea to look at The Guardian on something like this, because they tend to be fairly moderate but factual. As I said, that article by Kenneth Roth, it says the International Court of Justice ruling in South Africa's genocide case in their favour was a powerful repudiation of Israel's denialism. By an overwhelming majority, the court found a plausible case that provisional measures were needed to avoid irreparable prejudice from further Israeli acts in Gaza that could jeopardise Palestinian rights under the Genocide Convention. Public posture of various Israeli officials was, in essence, how dare anyone accuse us of genocide? After all, they pointed out, Israel was founded after the Holocaust to protect the Jewish people from genocide.
Well, that's just a specious argument, isn't it? You know, they've also lobbied the Israeli lobby over many years to prevent the Armenian massacres in World War One by the Turks from being classified as genocide, because the only genocide that ever took place was the one that was carried out against the Jews in Germany. And of course,
the Israelis are accusing the ICJ of being anti-Semites.
Well, they do that all the time, don't they? I mean, the fact is, I mean, the evidence, I think the overwhelming evidence of genocide in this case is the cutting off of food, water, medical supplies, and the bombing of hospitals. They're deliberately going out of their way to try and kill the civilian population, and also to try and drive them out, even though the Egyptians won't let them out.
Absolutely. This is, in a way, a total failure, this ruling by the ICJ, ordering Israel to ensure acts of genocide are not committed. It's doing them. It's been doing them for months, and it's doing them every day. It's doing them right this second.
Yes, but in any case, they were always going to ignore what they'd, and they've ignored all the UN resolutions over the years that have been passed against them. But when the West goes on about the rules-based order, we must stop Putin from having referendums where people can vote for what they want. We must stop the Nasrallah from ruling Yemen, because obviously they're bad actors, because they want to stop our consumer goods from getting through to us. All of these things are just special pleading by the powerful against the interests of the powerless.
And it may be that another ruling in a few weeks or a few months' time might go further, and that this is a way of saying to the Israelis, well, look, stop now, and you've saved a bit of your reputation. But is that likely to work?
Well, I think it's mainly what we're talking about here is the court of public opinion, because nobody can stop the Israelis apart from the Americans. If an Israeli general said, we can't fight for a single day,
the Israelis don't support it. Don't care about public opinion. They hope that the Western press, and that their pressure that they've been putting on the Western press in all sorts of different ways, will save them.
Well, they're hoping for that, but of course, the real big player in this is the United States of America. If the United States of America had been calling for a ceasefire and telling the Israelis, "Look, you're going to have a ceasefire here," they'd have to do it, and the British would no doubt be trotting along behind the Americans, going, "Yes, yes, they've got to do it."
Would they? I mean, the Russian guy was implying that the British and the Americans say one thing, actually, their real intentions, you know, behind the scenes are totally different.
Well, that's true, but of course, if the Americans were telling us that we had to that there was going to be a ceasefire, the British would go. I mean, don't forget, the Americans withdrew from Afghanistan without telling the British government what was happening, and the British government just got told we're going without any previous consultation. So we just do what we're told. That's what Britain does, and we do what the Americans say. But the Americans are in a position to tell the Israelis to stop, because they're supplying them with all of the weaponry that's being used to kill these children and their elderly parents and all the rest
of it. There was a bit of an anomaly at this announcement today at the International Court of Justice, where the lady judge who was reading it out said something about, well, such and such was supposed to read this out, but...
Punishment of the crime of genocide in the Gaza Strip, South Africa versus Israel. Judge Robinson, who duly participated in both the deliberation and the final vote, is, for reasons made known to me, unable to take his seat on the bench today.
So the guy who was supposed to read the judgment out wasn't there for some reason. I don't know if there'd been any sort of weird pressure put on him, like he'd been fried with a laser gun or something by the Israelis, but God knows. But anyway, so somebody else had to read it out. But let's have a listen now. It takes a couple of minutes for her to read the judgment out. But this is the judgment as read earlier today over in The Hague against Israel.
By 15 votes to 2, the State of Israel shall, in accordance with its obligations under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in relation to the Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. The State of Israel shall ensure, with immediate effect, that its military does not commit any acts described in point one above. The State of Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. The State of Israel shall take immediate and effective measures to ensure the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The State of Israel shall take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of Article 2 and Article 3 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide against members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. The State of Israel shall submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to this order within 1 month as from the date of the order.
So there you have the presiding judge, Joan Donoghue, the United States, sizing up the provisional measures that the court has agreed, the court of 17 members. No ceasefire is the headline amongst those, but humanitarian assistance is required.
Okay, well, that's the spin on it that we're getting from that particular source.
That was Al Jazeera there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said earlier, it's a bit of fudge. They've given them a month to stop killing, you know, killing civilians, and they've got to feed them and they've got to look after them.
But it is a fudge, isn't it? I think it's fair to say the whole thing is a fudge, really. There should be some kind of, you know, much more direct. So, for example, what they could have surely done is a ruling which did rule it as genocide, and it ruled that any body, for example, the Israeli war cabinet that travels around the world, any country that wished to could then arrest them for these war crimes. And the same could happen, of course, with those who had been supporting that, which was part of their case. The South Africans were making the case that there are other nations around the world that have either materially or verbally supported these war crimes.
Yeah, so obviously they're under a lot of pressure not to cause too much trouble for the Western powers, and that judge is obviously
I haven't gotten to the bottom of this. Yeah, exactly. It's an American voice we're hearing there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Reading this judgment out, and the very first thing I didn't include it in there, unfortunately. I should have done, really. But one of the first things she says is, oh, I'm very sorry that such and such can't read it out, and I'm not going to tell you why he's not here to read it out, but I'm here instead. So there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, you do wonder if there's... I mean, we go back to the Iraq War. We know, don't we, that the United States, the National Security Agency, was putting enormous pressure on at the United Nations Security Council to fix the vote. So maybe they did the same sort of thing.
Well,
here
you can imagine they've been twisting arms and crushing testicles with great enthusiasm to get the result they want. I think it's a partial victory for the South Africans, though, because the tune is changing if the actions haven't. The Americans are now saying, well, the Israelis they're not harming too many civilians. They're doing their best, but of course it's trying circumstances and so on. I think the pressure that all of us have been putting up has had some effect. And, but of course the Israelis are mad dogs and they're out of control.
Well, the Houthis are definitely making a difference. We'll be talking about that a bit later. But all this came up on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions, too, with the SNP leader, Stephen Flynn, putting it to Rishi Sunak, who you're actually a lawmaker. Do you understand law? Do you understand what law means and what international law is? And he put this question to him.
SNP leader Stephen Flynn.
Mr. Speaker, last night, as Tory MPs were once again fighting amongst themselves, the public were sat at home watching John Irvine of ITV News report on footage from Gaza of an unarmed Palestinian man walking under a white flag, being shot and killed by the IDF. Yes. Prime Minister, such an act constitutes a war crime, does it not?
Mr. Speaker, we've been absolutely consistent that international humanitarian law should be respected and civilians should be protected. I've made that point expressly to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the Foreign Secretary is in the region this week making exactly the same point.
Stephen Flynn.
Mr. Speaker, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom to rise to that dispatch box and tell the people of these isles and elsewhere that shooting an unarmed man walking under a white flag is a war crime. Now, in recent weeks, this House has acted with urgency and intent following an ITV drama. The question is, will this House now show the same urgency and intent following this ITV news report and finally back a ceasefire in Gaza?
Mr. Speaker, no one wants to see this conflict go on for a moment longer than necessary, and we do want to see an immediate and sustained humanitarian pause to get more aid in and, crucially, the hostages out, helping create the conditions for a sustainable ceasefire. I set out the conditions for that earlier in the House. The Foreign Secretary is in the region today, and we'll continue to press all our allies and partners to make sure that we can bring about that outcome.
So he's saying it's necessary that it carries on, isn't he, effectively? That's what the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, Goldmine Sachs, is saying there, who's on his way out, by the way, folks. This guy's just shelf life has gone, so several months ago, and he's standing there in the dispatch box, basically just rotting away, because nobody really wants him there. The Tory party don't want him there. The electorate don't want him there. The opposition maybe do want him there because he's performing so badly. At the end of the day, Martin, this is very much like Blair in Iraq, isn't it? The idea here is we don't really give a stuff about international law. This is really about the law of the jungle, and the use of force, and that's what matters in this world.
Well, I think it's interesting that if Keir Starmer had been standing at the smash box, he'd have been saying exactly the same thing, because the British position is that we're going to have a sustainable ceasefire by the destruction of Hamas. Now, everybody else in the world, including, say, the French and the Spanish and the Irish, or South Africans, obviously, many of the countries of the Muslim world and the developing world, they're all saying the same thing. We need a ceasefire here. And, of course, there have been ceasefires in the past in exactly these similar circumstances with the Israelis, between the Israelis and Hamas. But a ceasefire will involve the Israelis accepting that they cannot defeat Hamas. That's what it means. We're going to freeze this conflict here. Hamas is going to remain in play. And, of course, ultimately out of that could come a two-state solution, as suggested by the Russian ambassador earlier.
ITV were very... And every time they turned up, they were sticking this to Sunak. And this was also this week when he was out and about chatting to people or being interviewed by one of ITV's journalists. He put exactly the same question to him. This time not the SNP leader, just an ordinary journalist talking about war crimes. Do you actually know what one is? Mr. Prime Minister.
The images filmed by the ITV news cameraman of showing an innocent civilian being with a white flag being shot and murdered or killed in Gaza. Have you seen the images raised by the SNP yesterday, and do you think it's a war crime?
Look, well, as a general thing, what I'll say is we are concerned about the significant impact and loss of life of civilians in Gaza. I've been very clear about that. Now, whilst Israel, of course, has a right to remove the threat that Hamas poses to it and its people, it has to take care to protect civilians and do that in a way that complies with international law. You know, President Biden and I spoke about this earlier in the week. I've spoken to the Israeli Prime Minister about it. The Foreign Secretary is in the region reiterating those same messages. And what we want to see is a pause in what is happening so that we can get the hostages out and more aid into the region. And that's what, as I said, a priority for us is.
Well, they're calling for a pause. Everybody else is calling for a ceasefire, which could be a permanent ceasefire. Why not? And then we have a political solution. So, and in any case, the fact is that war crimes have already been committed. It's not a question of tutting at the Israelis and saying, please don't commit any more war crimes. They've already been committed. And you could argue that those who gave the orders for those crimes and those who carried them out should face prosecution. And that it's just mealy-mouthed stuff. And everybody who's following this in real time is just horrified by the disgusting things that have been done. Shooting people in bread queues, denying them food, summary executions of all kinds of civilians, including, you know, the two Christian elderly ladies who were on their way to the loo, shot by a sniper. The rest of the world has already worked out that this is war crimes.
Can I just interrupt you? Another thing this week was the United Nations Aid Centre. They were just distributing some aid, and the Israeli Defence Force unit started killing people, shooting at the aid workers and killing the people who were taking their aid. So let's have a listen to that report now.
Adnan Abu Hasna, who's also in Rafah. He's a spokesperson for UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Thank you very much for your time. I can imagine that you are extremely busy right now. I know these attacks are still ongoing and information is hard to get out as the shelling is continuing. But can you just update us with what you know about these latest strikes in Khan Yunis on your facilities there?
Yes, 1 hour ago, it seemed that three shells had been landed inside the KYTC, the training center of Khan Yunis that belongs to UNRWA, and there are many casualties, actually, and the building had been set on fire. There, we are trying to send some ambulances there, coordinating with the Israeli side. We hope that we can get into there, you know, very soon. We don't have updated, you know, information about how many people have been killed or injured. We are waiting, you know, maybe after 1 hour, we will be aware of all the information.
Mm. Was there any warning before these strikes happened?
No, you know, we have not been able to, you know, to get in and from the compound, you know, in the last 48 hours because, you know, the Israeli tanks actually very close to the compound, to the college, actually. And we were aware, and we believe that it's very dangerous, you know, there. We try to coordinate the exit of people, those of the IDPs, the internally displaced people there, but we did not succeed, unfortunately, in the last 48 hours.
I mean, this isn't anywhere near the first time that Israeli military has targeted UNRWA facilities. Why do you think that it keeps happening?
It's not the first time. Nearly, we have nearly 130 UNRWA facilities had been attacked or had been hit directly or indirectly. you know, and hundreds of displaced people had been killed or injured. And we at UNRWA, we had nearly 152 of our colleagues also had been killed. So it's not the first time, but maybe it's the first time that we see such huge fire and, you know, people are screaming, crying, asking for help. We hope that we will not find so many people had been killed and injured. You know, we are waiting. Maybe after 1 hour, we will be aware of how really what happened and how much people, you know, had been killed or injured. Mm.
So that's an Al Jazeera report about that. Turns out, Martin, they killed the Israeli killed 20 people and wounded dozens more at this aid centre. As people were giving out aid, and just in the last few hours, the Israelis said, well, the reason we targeted it is because we believe some of the UN aid agency staff were involved in the October the 7th attacks.
Well, they're just coming out with anything, aren't they? I mean, one of the things that the ICJ did say was that people...
And the United States, by the way, literally, this is just a few minutes ago, has paused funding for UNRWA, because they say that they believe the, this is on France 24 saying this, that they believe that the Israelis may be right and that some of these staff, were involved in this October the 7th attacks. They haven't said why or who, but they have, the United States has now paused funding for this aid agency.
Well, I mean, what's happening is disgusting in every possible way. And, the attempts to try and justify these terrible killings by the Western politicians are absolutely despicable. And, of course, the rest of the world can see what's going on here. The idea that we are somehow restraining the Israelis, meanwhile we're supplying them, Akrotiri, which is a base in Cyprus controlled by the British, is being used as a place where our planes flew from there to bomb Yemen. We're supplying the Israelis with lots of weaponry. That weaponry is ending up killing people in refugee camps
Gazans,
in Gaza.
The Gazans are saying that they've now got roughly two-thirds of the population have either got diarrhea or cholera.
Well, this is another thing, but the ICJ picks up on the intention to genocide. And of course, you've got statements by senior Israeli officials and generals saying we're going to kill them all. Let's, you know, exterminate the brutes. Now, that is as clear evidence as you could possibly have of intent to genocide. And, of course, the whole point of the Genocide Act, as it was put together at the end of the war, was that you were supposed to act before the genocide is fulfilled. It's not there to punish genocide after it's been committed. The purpose of the genocide treaty is to prevent it before it happens. And the Israelis are clearly in a position, to my mind, of in danger of killing through things like using disease as a way of killing off the population.
This is biological warfare.
It's biological warfare, absolutely.
As used to happen in medieval sieges, this kind of thing. But look, really one of the worst examples I've seen for a long time is the BBC Question Time production team keeping Gaza out of their discussions on BBC. They usually only have time for 3 or 4 questions, which is ridiculous. They should be able to get through more. So people are very verbose, like Martin and I on there, and with a decent chair you get through a hell of a lot more ground. But they've expanded the number of guests on there. But anyway, last night there were some audience members who are quite clearly detected this BBC bias in not wanting Gaza discussed, even though, of course, there's on a Thursday evening, the next day there was about to be this massive announcement at the ICJ about whether it was genocide or not. Apparently it is, but the Israelis have been given a little bit of a free hand to carry on for a while by the ICJ for some reason. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to BBC Question Time last night, where right at the very end, one of the audience members was so frustrated that they started shouting out, why aren't you talking about Gaza? Why aren't you talking about this genocide on this programme? And actually, I think it was Barry Gardiner, one of the Labour MPs who was on the panel, eventually, you will hear in a minute, does talk about it. But this is the only way, it seems, to get the BBC to discuss Gaza and this genocide being carried out by the Israeli state in Gaza on their programme, which, of course, is... chaired by this lady from Antiques Roadshow. So let's have a look at the discussion. The final question on the programme, and it always seems to me now that it's a bit of a messy end on that show, whereas old Dibbleby used to finish it off, even though he was a Bullingdon Club boy, rather nice and tidily. BBC Question Time's Gaza censorship now, and the final question which was asked, which was some very good answers to it, by the way, is how do we create a positive future for our young people? And then towards the end you'll hear one of the young people shouting and screaming in the background, what about genocide, what about Gaza? So why not give her a voice, Fiona Bruce? Why not give her a voice, BBC? Why not give her a voice, Question Time? Well, they tried not to, but of course, she got her voice out just by shouting and screaming on that live well, it's not quite a live programme. It's recorded, I think, about an hour before it goes out.
So, Sonia, well, how do we create hope for a positive future for John's son and all the other young
people? I want us to crack our housing crisis, because I think it's a blight for young people. It's fine if you've got parents with wealth who can help you get on the housing ladder. For some young people, there's no jobs in their local area. They can't, no jobs of prospects. They can't move to where the jobs are. The way I would do it, because I think we're about solutions now for your 15-year-old, is we used to have council housing in this country that people were proud to live in. After the Second World War, you know, between 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 people lived in council housing. We now call it social housing. That's the wrong term. It makes it sound like a handout. It's not a handout. It's decent housing for not-for-profit rent. It's rent that doesn't go to lining the pockets of landlords. Okay. We need public investment in housing again, and we need to give a guarantee. If I were the Labour government, we need to give a guarantee to people in their 20s. You will get a set number of years in affordable, good quality, rented housing.
You have to be quite brief, I'm afraid, competent.
I think Sonia's absolutely right on a practical level, but I think at a cultural level there's something perhaps even more important, which is we've got to stop talking down our country. I'm a first-generation immigrant to this country, and I get annoyed hearing people talk endlessly about how we're the worst country in the world, we're the most sexist country in the world, we're the most racist country. It's all nonsense. This is one of the best places to live in the world, and that's what we should be talking about. The fact that we're... This is exactly the problem that I'm talking about. You are saying shame on you for talking up Britain. And that is exactly the problem we're talking about. This is one of the best places to live in the world for minorities like me. It's the best place to
wait a minute.
Be a woman. It's
can I just say there's no point in shouting out for everyone because the people at home can't hear you. So and also let's try not to talk over each other. I asked Constantine a question. In fairness, I have to let him answer.
So we've got to stop talking down our country.
Okay.
We've got to stop shouting over people who are talking.
I've got 2 minutes left and I have to let the rest of the panel answer. Let me just do that. Bronwyn.
We do something about housing, we do something about climate change, and we tell the young people, I've got a 21-year-old daughter, we tell them they're really, really nice people. It is a great generation that is coming.
Alex.
I think that there are grounds for hope, and it's grounds for hope in a way that I think automatically appeals to young people, and that is in the white heat of technology that is coming. That you have the advances in artificial intelligence, in quantum computing and the
I know you want to make your point. Well, let's just wait 1 second. I know you want to make your point, but we've been asked a question, and that's how this programme works. The panel answer the question asked by Craig Sir Jones. So that's what we're going to do. Please let the panel answer. Please let the panel answer the question. Alex, I'm sorry. Please let the panel answer the question. Alex.
But this new technology stands the chance of radically transforming our whole world by creating very cheap energy and the capacity to solve problems that we've never had the capability to do so before. And I think that that is really appealing to the next generation.
Jonathan, we've got about 30 seconds left. So
we can turn the page after 14 years. But let me say this. The killing has to stop. We need a truce on humanitarian grounds immediately. And we need a ceasefire, a sustainable ceasefire. That's what we need now. And a Labour government will work towards the creation of a Palestinian state as part of a two-state solution. That is hope.
OK. Right. Listen, our hour is up. Thank you for all your questions. I just want to say thank you very much to Giovanna Pomiglio, who supplied the photographs here, that you can see, of where we are in Gillingham tonight. Thank you very much for all your questions. really appreciate you all coming here tonight. We are in Glasgow next week, and then, of course, we're in Nottingham. So if you'd like to come along to that programme, we'd love to see you. But
it's time for us to depart from the Antiques Roadshow today.
From Question Time in Gillingham this evening. Bye-bye.
So that was me being a bit cheeky there and cutting in a bit of Antiques Roadshow. But they really are, I mean, fair play, fantastic to that audience member there, bringing up genocide, bringing up Gaza, shouting it out as loud as they could. You could just about make it out once you realised that that's what she was shouting about. They did everything they could to. And, of course, Fiona Bruce, just completely, loyal to her producers or whoever's put her in that position. Labour's shadow paymaster general, it was Jonathan Ashworth MP, who shared with the audience there and on television what that actual shouting was all about, which was about genocide, it was about Gaza, and it was also about Fiona Bruce and BBC Question Time completely refusing, in fact censoring, this issue and making sure that it wasn't discussed. It was one of the most important things going on in the world today, but it's not going to be on the Fiona Bruce Question Time roadshow.
Well, I'd be interested to know how that Labour MP voted on the ceasefire vote, because he may also be part of the problem rather than part of the solution. But I think it is also very significant that the BBC doesn't see fit to debate what is clearly the major issue in international politics this week on their show. I mean, stuff about how can we make the future better for young people is, you know, it's not unworthy of discussion, but it's hardly the topic of the moment, is it? It's flim-flam.
What about the basic destruction of the BBC current affairs? I mean, you know, having that woman, Fiona Bruce, in charge just seems completely a mess. Almost, I mean, you could do the job, fine. There's loads of other people who could do the job, but she is there quite clearly to try and brush over. It seems last night that she seemed to hope that she was going to be able to get away with just making sure that even though that woman was screaming and shouting about Gaza, about genocide, about ceasefire, about the killing of children, that it wasn't even going to get out if she had her way. It was actually only the Labour MP that made sure that we all knew that what the woman was shouting about.
Well, I presume if he hadn't spoken up, they could have edited it all out before it was broadcast. But I think that, you know, all power to the elbow of the person who did that, because there was no question about Gaza. So the only way they can get it on the agenda is by shouting from the back, because you've not chosen to discuss it.
Well, Jonathan Ashworth, for your information and for our audience, he abstained on the vote for the ceasefire.
Okay, well, that's better than voting with the government. But never, you know, and you can see that, you know, there are people like him in the Labour Party who are very...
There's quite a lot of MPs, Labour MPs, that voted for it, though. He wasn't one of them.
No, but at least he didn't vote with Starmer against the ceasefire. I mean, I think the position of people like him is going to become untenable going forward.
There are very few Labour MPs that did vote against it. So he was, there was a sort of 50-50 split. Some voted for it, and some voted, I mean, for example, Tahrir Ali voted for it, Labour MP Rosina Alancan,
yeah,
she voted for it from Tooting, and so there's a kind of 50-50 split. You're right to point out that he abstained.
Well, he abstained because he's in the cabinet, the shadow cabinet.
He's in the shadow cabinet.
So if he'd voted against, he'd have had to resign from the shadow cabinet.
Still, I think it says a lot about the state of BBC current affairs. And, of course, they keep having these things on called fact-check units and, these various attempts to convince us that the BBC is trustworthy, when it's quite obvious from that performance last night that they're not, Martin.
Well, I think the problem for the BBC is that they're under the cosh of the government and the Israeli lobby.
There's all sorts of stories to do with this which aren't getting out there. One of them was spilled by Loki last weekend's big demonstration. Behind the scenes, this was recorded in Birmingham.
Britain has had a very duplicitous role, because on one side it has attempted to depict itself as somehow respecting the norms of international law, while at the same point, as has been revealed in the last few days, David Cameron, the foreign minister, who himself was a patron of the Jewish National Fund, which is the largest settlement building body in Palestine, he left his position as a patron when he became prime minister before. But that clearly would give anyone the reasonable perception that he has a conflict of interest, especially when you consider that, or at least he had a conflict of interest. The JNF had, on as an other patrons, Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli president as well, and still does. So for David Cameron to have that relationship and then go into the role as foreign minister, there would be serious question marks in any seriously functioning media and political system. But what happened is David Cameron goes into that role. He then receives advice. He receives advice on the 10th of December that sending weapons to Israel would not be wise and would likely lead to those weapons being used for violations of international humanitarian law. Now, David Cameron okayed those transactions to go ahead on the 10th of December. That clearly puts a level of complicity with what has happened in Gaza on the British government. Let's not forget that the Apache helicopters that Israel used, they contain components that come from British companies that are produced here. The F-16 fighter jets that Israel used contain the targeting technology from BAE Systems, which is Israel, which is Britain's largest arms manufacturer. Britain has sold sniper rifle components and sniper rifles to the Israelis in the last decade or so, and more recently than that. So therefore, when we see these Christian women in Gaza who were shot inside a church where they were displaced and sheltering with sniper rifles, it's entirely possible that those sniper rifles came from the British government.
Yeah, so that's low-key there, chit-chatting to somebody behind the scenes at the Birmingham Palestine rally last weekend.
Yeah, I think what's interesting that he said there, that Foreign Office advice, the legal advice that David Cameron was given, Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton, was that it would be potentially these arms were going to be used for genocide, and therefore the legal advice was that we shouldn't be providing weaponry to the Israelis.
Isn't it interesting?
And he overruled that, and then when he was questioned about it, he tried to pretend that he hadn't been given the advice and that no advice had been tendered.
All sounds a bit like Iraq, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, Craig Murray was picking up on this. He must have been given
advice.
So this
is the idea.
Legal advice that they shouldn't do it, and he overruled the legal advice.
This is the idea now, isn't it? Sunak and King Charles are surrounding themselves with all these people who know that it's okay to break the law because it's actually might is right, the law of the jungle rules, and if you're into international law, then you're a ninny.
Well, I think the thing is that they're caught in a cleft stick. Because at the same time, they're intervening in Yemen and in Ukraine, supposedly in defence of international law. But when Israel carries out... I mean, the Israelis have killed far more civilians in Gaza than the Russians have killed in the Ukraine, probably by several times, you know. And that's in a few weeks, not in 2 years. But apparently, according to the general speaking earlier, we need conscription to fight the Russians. I say, let's not fight the Russians. They were our allies in World War II. Maybe we do need a war against Israel. And don't forget, Britain has been at war with Israel. We were at war with the terrorists that created the State of Israel in the 1940s. And Ernie Bevin, who was the foreign minister at that time, was opposed to the creation of the State of Israel for two reasons. A, because he didn't think it was a good idea. And in fact, it's becoming increasingly clear that it wasn't a good idea. And the Israelis are foolish to bring that question up, but it is being asked again now, should there be a State of Israel at all? And the second point being, they shouldn't be allowed to have it on the basis of the way they went about getting it, killing loads of civilians and carrying out terrorist acts, including the assassination of Lord Moyne, the British government's representative. Now, in the past, in the 1940s, you wouldn't have had many people in Britain had a good word to say about the Israeli government. How things have changed. They've now become the white knights, which we support whatever they do. Back in the day, we had a more robust attitude towards these.
Yeah,
people.
We certainly did. One thing we must do is mark the death of Gonzalo Lira. I suppose you've heard about this, Martin. This guy, do you want to say a little bit about him? He was a blogger over in Ukraine. He was very critical of the Ukrainians. He was, first of all, he was incarcerated and released by the SBU, their secret police. And then he was trying to make his way to the Hungarian border to get out of the country. He was arrested just a few miles from the... He'd actually cycled, or on his bike, maybe it was a motorbike, I'm not sure. And then he was arrested and put in prison. And he said, well, look, if you don't hear from me, I'll be dead. And it was announced over Christmas and the New Year that he had indeed died in prison, Gonzalo Lira.
Yeah, I understand that he was needed medical attention. It was denied to him. Lots of people have died in Ukrainian prisons. Lots of people have been disappeared. Many political parties in Ukraine have been banned. And in actual fact, the media has been completely controlled by Zelensky for several years. In many ways,
it's a bit like the whole Milosevic thing, isn't it? Jail means we're either going to prosecute you or just kill you here.
Well, also, the other thing that Zelensky has done is there's supposed to be an election in Ukraine this year, and he's just cancelled it.
Well, let's have a listen.
The Russian election will go ahead.
Tucker Carlson did an interview with Gonzalo's father. Let's have a listen to a bit of that now.
Neither I nor his sister living in the USA, and I'm reading because I don't want to lose anything. Neither I nor his sister living in the USA have been able to communicate with Gonzalo. He's incommunicado. The U.S. Embassy has not answered our inquiries. The embassy in Kyiv never offered a defense attorney, never visited him, except for the first time, his court appointment last November 8th. The embassy has just burned out Gonzalo. An American citizen by birth is in jail, because he was exercising his right of freedom of speech. His defense, as I said before, is in the hands of a court appointment Ukrainian attorney that doesn't speak any English. The USA government, with its silence in the face of this scandalous incident, suggests a degree of complicity, or at least tacit approval of Gonzalo's arrest. Since nothing else convincingly explains the conspicuous lack of response. Let me just read further, if I may, Tucker.
I hope you will.
Gonzalo was arrested last year on April the 15th, Good Friday, till the next Friday, 22nd, for that full week, without any charges. He was simply detained. They stole all of his equipment. He couldn't continue working after he was released for at least 2-3 weeks trying to obtain equipment to continue. His criticism of Zelensky's Nazi regime, supported by the U.S. government, by Mr. Biden, who makes, you know, he is making gargles, you know, that we have to defend democracy. What democracy?
Gonzalo Lira's father there, speaking to Tucker Carlson, Martin, and we hear lots and lots, CNN, all the world reporting about it just yesterday, 100th day in a Russian jail for American Russian journalists. They're talking about Evan Gershevich. So these journalists matter, people like Gonzalo Lira, who've been not only been jailed by the Ukrainians, but killed by them in prison.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're getting a very partial version of events, aren't we, in mainstream media in the West. I mean, I'm just astonished by how, you know, the people still haven't changed. You know, the moral bankruptcy and political bankruptcy of Western policy towards Ukraine is unbelievable. But of course, it's very hard for them to change direction over Israel or over Ukraine, because they've got to admit basically that it was all wrong. But of course, they've got to admit a lot of what they've done has all been wrong. We shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan. We shouldn't have invaded Iraq. We shouldn't have tried to overthrow the government of Libya. We shouldn't have tried to overthrow the government of Syria. And we shouldn't have responded to the peace deal in the Ukraine by demanding more war. But that is what Britain's position has been. Oh, and I didn't mention that we've also gone to war with the government of Yemen and the people of Yemen, who've suffered for many decades under our boot, because we've been helping the Saudis to oppress
them. No, but the Houthis are terrorists.
Well, that's right, isn't it? Everybody's a terrorist except us. But if you think of the millions of people who've died in all the wars I've just mentioned, we, or the British government, is directly responsible for all that chaos and carnage. and then we want to come home and discuss a future for our young people.
It's interesting, yeah, especially on the BBC, but we're not allowed to mention Gaza for the young
people. I suppose the future for our young people is conscripted to go and die in the Ukraine.
Well, I don't think people will do that.
That'll sort him out.
This is the thing, isn't it? Actually, are people really going to do that? Let's wind up our political section with a chat. We're going to have a chat to Catherine Gunn in a moment about GCHQ. There's a big demonstration taking place tomorrow by the trade unions for the right to strike and the right to be in a trade union in Cheltenham tomorrow. But before that, I spotted a really good piece, I think it was on TikTok, about Christian Zionism, including contributions from the Naturi Carter rabbis. A chap, one of their rabbis, called Yisrael David Weiss. Miko Peled, whose father was a general in the Israeli Defense Forces, and our very own Reverend Stephen Sizer from Virginia Water, the Reverend in the Church of England, who's written the book Zionist Roadmap to Armageddon. So let's have a listen now to this sort of summary, really, looking at Christian Zionism and Zionism more generally, the whole idea of the Israeli state, what it's really all about.
Dear friends, as president of the state of Israel, we, the people of Israel, are eternal, and no one will break us.
I was a Zionist, and it's very difficult to break away from that very compelling story. I grew up in this very patriotic Zionist environment. Everybody talked about contributing to the state. My grandfathers, my uncles, my parents, I mean, my great-grand, you know, everybody, the state, contributing to the state was everything. It was the most important thing. Particularly after 1967, this new kind of religious Zionism received a huge impetus, a huge kind of, you know, boost. And they took over the role of being the pioneers. So in the early years, the pioneers were like my parents' generation. Now the pioneers were them, and they went to the West Bank, to all these, you know, supposedly holy places, places that are mentioned in the Bible, and they became the new pioneers. But they brought this combination of religion and nationalism, which of course is very toxic.
We have a choice of either beating the Arabs, killing the Arabs, move them out, because it's either the Arabs or Jews. There is not the slightest possibility of coexistence between us in the same country.
They uprooted their hearts and souls from God, and they're busy impressing the indigenous people, the Palestinian people, for God's creation, God's people. They're killing and murdering and maiming. And this is what we have. We have a total turning on its head.
It was the same belief behind the Crusades, the belief that the Crusades had God on their side and that God would vindicate them. History is replete with failed prophecies and lots of casualties among those who believe that kind of thinking.
Now today, when we see this terrible genocide going on in Gaza, you still find those so-called religious soldiers.
Zachor et asher asa lecha ma'amalek nitztavenu. Anu zochrim v'anu nilchamim.
In the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, the first group in the Bible that attacked the Jewish community, the people of Israel as they were leaving Egypt, was this group, Amalek. I don't view the Palestinians as being the Amalekites or Amalek.
The Zionists pretend that the Old Testament is a history book, and so if there's a reference to Amalek in that, it means it's history. And then from time to time they drop the religion, and from time to time they bring it back in whenever it's convenient.
איך ידעתם לשים את זה פה? אני קורא את זה כציווי לפעולה שכל דור צריך לעשות כדי להבטיח את נצח ישראל.
We need to understand this hypocrisy. You have a person that refuses to follow the religion and then uses a religion for something.
אנחנו בני האור, הם בני החושך, והאור ינצח את החושך.
Israel is, frankly, an apartheid regime. It's based on a supremacist theology and a political dogma that says that we are the chosen people, we are superior, we're unaccountable to international law, the UN, or whoever.
The earth is ours, and we have to say it and talk about it. It's not just a mess. The earth, including Judah and Shomron, and no occupied territory, and no sismos, and no secrets that have been exiled in the international law.
הארץ שלנו! כל הארץ! כל הארץ!
As Netanyahu seeks to build support for campaigns like what we're seeing right now in Gaza, you will see that he and other Israeli leaders use multiple justifications depending on the audience that he's talking to.
We have no better friends in the world than our Christian friends. And I want to thank each of you for your friendship.
That's Netanyahu finishing that. So I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, a link to the video with the subtitles and things, which, we had a bit of Hebrew there without the subtitles. But he's saying there, we have no better friends than our Christian friends. Actually, what's been happening is churches and Christians in Gaza have been being murdered, killed, part of this genocide.
That's right. And, of course, the Christian Zionists are actually anti-Semites. They believe that the Jews will all be converted to Christianity at the final days, and those that aren't will go to hell, and everybody else is going to have the rapture. They're not part of the mainstream of Christian theology at all. And a lot of it comes from the Plymouth Brethren I was reading the other day. The idea of the providentialism and the rapture and so on is a relatively recent innovation in theology. I mean, it's not really there in Protestant theology traditionally at all. So a lot of this stuff is just made up stuff.
Anyway, leaping on to tomorrow's trade union demonstration in Cheltenham, I had a chat to, and I'll put a full version of this up too on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, fascinating chat, I thought, with Iraq war whistleblower Catherine Gunn, who was a Chinese Mandarin translator and analyst who was brought up in Taiwan. So she talks a little bit about that whole conflict going on between the Americans sort of inflaming things between the Taiwanese and the Chinese. Very, very good analysis, and it's really fantastic to have somebody who was a top analyst on China at GCHQ doing reports for us here. So she had this to say about why she thinks we should shut GCHQ down, because their role today has morphed from keeping an eye on foreign enemies to actually surveillance here at home.
GCHQ, it's evolved over time. It was created, I think, during the Second World War in order to try and break German codes. And since then, GCHQ has expanded gradually, increasingly over time. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's now resembling some sort of giant kind of squid over the whole of the UK. The main purpose of GCHQ is national security, serious and organized crime, and economic well-being. But these are such kind of amorphous terms that they obviously can expand it to whatever they think it's necessary. And GCHQ, along with every other kind of intelligence agency, is obviously part and parcel of the whole entire military industrial complex. And that whole complex has now expanded to include biosecurity surveillance. So they're just increasing their footprint over the whole of the country.
What is biosecurity surveillance? And also the other thing which is part of GCHQ's mission, which seems a little bit strange, is this whole thing of economic well-being. What if there's some kind of British corporation that is at loggerheads with the British public? I mean, what side do they take? So you've got here biosecurity and economics. That really seems to be much more to do with surveillance rather than actually protecting the people, you know, the national security.
Yeah, it is. And we saw the biosecurity surveillance come into view during the whole scamdemic. That whole 3 years of where they wanted to test everybody and make sure everybody distance, social distancing and all that nonsense that they were insisting on. This is the new paradigm. They're creating business for themselves. They're creating a purpose for themselves. And I think the whole point of these sorts of intelligence gathering organizations, they're never really outwardly focused. They say that they're outwardly focused, but in actual fact, it's all about controlling the domestic population. And I've now come to the realization that GCHQ and basically all of the intelligence services, they're weaponized against the people, and they always have been. I mean, a lot of this came out in 2013, 14, 15 with the Snowden revelations and so on. But that seems to have died off, you know, and GCHQ has tried to reinvent itself, because it was really back then, everybody had a really bad reputation. It had a bad reputation. You know, people thought, oh, how dare they do these things? We're not criminals. We're all innocent. Why should they have access to all of our information? And so they had to do a massive, big rebranding in order to sell themselves. And it's the same with, you know, NSA. They're trying to promote themselves as protecting the British public from hacking and online subversion and election meddling and all this kind of stuff in order to justify their encroachment into our lives, you know, and it's the whole narrative is just, it's just a sham in my view.
So there's a longer interview with Catherine I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Apparently, Martin, they now use Catherine Gunn for new people who are being brought in from university to work at GCHQ. Oh, here's an example of somebody who is a very misguided person. Actually, what she did was very extremely important, wasn't it? That is to say, blew the whistle on the fact that the United Nations was being fixed by the National Security Agency in the United States, that what they were doing was targeting and bullying and distorting a vote at the Security Council of the United Nations. So she did a very, very important job, and yet she's now being painted as some sort of pariah by the GCHQ people.
Well, you can imagine that she would be. Because she obviously broke ranks and grasped up what was going on, the manipulations around the Iraq war.
The subtext of that, of course, is they're saying to all these new recruits, look what we're, you know, you better not even think about what will happen to you if you think of doing something like this.
Well, of course, other recruits, the intelligence services end up cutting into little pieces and put into suitcases, don't they?
What about that film, Official Secrets? If people haven't seen it, please do watch it about Catherine Gunn's case. It became pretty clear in there was such a lot of pushback at The Observer from Yvonne Ridley, who was the conduit between Catherine and The Observer, that a lot of people at The Observer didn't want to print the story even. So Catherine could have maybe risked her neck for nothing.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's people who stick their necks out like that are to be congratulated, because without them, we would have a much weaker picture of what's actually going on. And of course, it is very sinister what's going on. I mean, the intelligence services are not there to protect us. A country probably does need some kind of an intelligence service, but the mission creep and the delusion of the world view of the people at the top of these institutions is dangerous to the point of disastrous.
It seems to me pretty simple. You can sum up what the intelligence services are doing these days. In fact, many other institutions related to the Foreign Office, a Home Office, etc., is that actually what has happened is Britain has lost the international competition for to be in any way economically successful or competitive around the world. And so what they're looking to do is to attack and undermine the countries like China and Russia who are doing so well.
Well, I think it's they are part of a you know, the intelligence services have got a history like everything else has got a history. They're part of the military-industrial complex, the British Empire and all the rest of it. And, for example, in the British Empire, in Kenya, for example, in the 1950s, it wasn't MI6 who were in charge of the internal security, it was MI5. And GCHQ has obviously grown from a very small beginnings to become a global player in these games. But the underlying problem is the imperialist nature of the British state. We just go around the world causing problems. all sorts of problems around the world today are a direct result of British interference.
It ain't random. It ain't random that the British kicked and Allenby kicked the Ottomans out of Palestine. It ain't random that the Israeli state was set up at the end of the Second World War. And we're going to finish now tonight looking at this whole idea of the Antichrist. I'm sure you'll love this, Martin, but there's a pastor, John MacArthur, in the United States, who's making it absolutely clear to all his followers in one of those massive churches that looks like a sort of super cinema with all these kind of slightly mesmerized looking people in there who don't actually applaud or sort of seem to respond at all as he makes these great pronouncements. He's saying that the Antichrist will be a Muslim and will be the Mahdi, which is the heroic savior that the Muslims hope for, in a similar way that Christians hope for the return of Jesus, that kind of thing. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Pastor John MacArthur explain why he thinks the Mahdi, a Muslim leader to come in the future, will be the Antichrist.
Their holy writings say this: the Mahdi will come riding on a white horse, and it even says in their writings, as it says in Revelation 6, 1 and 2. Saddam Hussein, by the way, painted murals of this Mahdi on white horse all over Baghdad, and he comes carrying a sword to kill the infidels. When the Mahdi arrives, he will discover hidden scriptures. He will discover them, interestingly enough, somewhere near the Sea of Galilee. And there will be there hidden scriptures, hidden gospels, and a hidden Torah. And they will be the true scriptures which will be used by the Mahdi to show the Jews and the Christians they were wrong, that their scriptures were the false scriptures. Let me summarize. The Mahdi will be a messianic figure. He will be a descendant of Muhammad. He will be an unparalleled, unequaled leader. He will come out of a crisis of turmoil. He will take control of the world. He will establish a new world order. He will destroy all who resist him. He will invade many nations. He will make a 7-year peace treaty with the Jews. He will conquer Israel and massacre the Jews. He will establish Islamic world headquarters at Jerusalem. He will rule for 7 years, establish Islam as the only religion. He will come on a white horse with supernatural power. He will be loved by all people on earth. If that sounds familiar, that is a precise description of the biblical Antichrist. Absolutely, step by step by step by step. The Bible's Antichrist is their Mahdi. We know that the rider on the white horse in Revelation 6 is the Antichrist. They use that verse to describe their Mahdi. Why am I giving you all this? Because the description of the Mahdi is exactly the description of the biblical Antichrist, the beast of Revelation 13. And you go into any kind of a study of that and you will find that all the details match up perfectly. The Bible's Antichrist is Islam's savior.
So that's good old Pastor John MacArthur there, putting forward the possibility, Martin, that the Mahdi, which is the future saviour, the person that brings many of these Islamic countries together, will be the Antichrist.
Well, I mean, they're all supping from the same pot, isn't it? I mean, don't forget that Islam only came into existence after the existence of Judaism and Christianity.
Well, certainly so, after the writing of the
Book
of Revelation.
Well, that's right. So in other words, they what the Muslims incorporated into their eschatology is the stuff that was already floating around.
As far as I understand, there's nothing really in the Quran about this. This is in the Hadiths, which
that's
are
right.
equivalent to a little bit like the Talmud. So these are writings around the Holy Scriptures by rabbis, by mullahs, etc., not the actual scriptures themselves. So, I mean, and then he has the cheek to say, we know that this person, you know, so he's not trying to persuade and interpret. He's just saying, well, I've already had a look at this and I've decided this is the way it is. Actually, I think any honest interpreter of these biblical scriptures. But what the point I'm trying to make with this little piece, Martin, is why it annoys me that these big institutions, massive media institutions, don't really look at this. And they should be pulling all these things apart in detailed documentaries, but they don't. They ignore it. In fact, they try and even ignore the fact that there's a genocide going on of biblical proportions in Gaza right now.
Well, I mean, I'm just opposed to his way of talking about the world anyway. If you can't predict who's going to win the 230 at Newmarket next week, and AI can't predict that, never mind ordinary human beings, then you can't really predict what the future's going to be. The Book of Revelation was written a long time ago in completely different circumstances than the ones we live in. The people like him who do believe what's in it are dangerous. Because they don't, they actually want the world
to
end.
I do.
Well, okay, Tony, but I don't, Tony. I'm afraid I don't. I'm afraid I'm with Socrates on this.
Well, you don't have to say I'm afraid. It's fine. Some people do, some people don't. The point I'm trying to make here is about interpretation. What he's doing is he's saying, I've interpreted this for everybody. You don't even have to think about it or look at it. I've interpreted it, and this is the way things are. The Muslims are the Antichrist, you know. So this, of course, is making all sorts of trouble. So what I thought I'd do is I'd approach somebody who is a Muslim, a guy called Kevin Barrett, who we work with on and off, Martin and I did, in the 9/11 Truth Movement, to see what he made of these sorts of accusations. Who will the Antichrist be? Will they be a Zionist or the Mahdi?
I think the reason that the Satanists kind of picked up where the Jews left off, that is, that this satanic project to commit abominations in the Holy Land grows out of Judaism and not Christianity and Islam, is that Messianic millenarian Judaism is already pretty messed up. You know, it calls for a Messiah who will be a military conqueror. The reason that the Jewish authorities didn't accept Jesus as Messiah is that Jesus was not a military conqueror who subjugated the Goyim, that is the non-Jewish tribes, to the Jews. So this kind of mainstream, traditional Jewish view of the Messiah that they're waiting for is that he will be a military conqueror who will subjugate all of the non-Jews to the Jews and rule the world from Jerusalem. And the Jews will all have hundreds or even thousands, I forget how many, Goyim slaves. That's mainstream Judaism. That's the mainstream Jewish tradition, which is already pretty bad. And so now you can imagine that a Satanist will say, yeah, you know, that's because, you know, if your Messiah is somebody like that, you're already really a Satanist without saying so. And I guess, you know, the Jewish authorities have various ways of explaining how this type of military conquering racist Messiah who puts them on top and makes everybody else their slave is really a good guy, and they're good people too, and they're not Satanists.
A lot of these discussions are around different interpretations of eschatology. This concept of the end of the world as prophesied in the Bible, and I'm not sure, you know, you're much better versed in, I'm sure, in looking at the Islamic tradition. But I noticed recently one of these US pastors, John MacArthur, came up with a very clarion call saying that the Mahdi, which is the uniting force of Islam in Islamic eschatology, is the Antichrist, he says. So this will be the Antichrist. So there seems to be a bit of contesting going on already as to who's going to be who in this final Armageddon battle.
Yeah, this notion that we're getting from Zionists and Satanists that the Mahdi would be the Antichrist is rather hilarious, because obviously these people haven't gone to kindergarten yet and learned that the Jewish Messiah is the reason that the Jews are still waiting for a Messiah is that they rejected and some say crucified Jesus. And I think we can all agree that either they crucified Jesus or they tried to crucify Jesus. And, you know, that's a long discussion between Christian and Muslim scriptural interpretations. But in any case, okay, so the Jews have rejected Jesus with very few exceptions. The Muslims accept Jesus as a very holy, special holy prophet, the Ruach al-Qudus, the Holy Spirit. God breathed his breath into Jesus and we accept the Immaculate Conception and basically accept Jesus's teachings. And pretty much the Christians and the Muslims are totally on the same page with Jesus's birth, Jesus's teachings. And the one point of difference would be the significance of the alleged crucifixion and so on and so forth. But in any case, so Muslims are pro-Christ. Christians are pro-Christ. Jews are anti-Christ. So obviously, the Jews who've rejected Jesus and are waiting for a military conqueror Messiah who will enslave the world to them are the ones who are on the side of Antichrist. Muslims, who like Christians, love and adore and venerate Jesus, are not. And in the Muslim eschatology, the Mahdi will be working with Jesus. And you know, people have different views of precisely how that could play out. But the whole point of the Mahdi is to usher in the return of Jesus. Every Muslim accepts that Jesus is the one and only Messiah, and it is his return that we're waiting for. And the Mahdi is simply his helper. So this notion that the Mahdi would be the Antichrist is Zionist propaganda designed to obscure the reality that Judaism is an Antichrist religion and that Islam, like Christianity, is a pro-Christ religion.
So that's Kevin Barrett there. I'll put the full interview with the US pastor and the full interview that I did this week with Kevin Barrett up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk for your delectation. I think fascinating discussions should be being had on a, like literally on a national level by, if it's not the state, then the broadcasters, the churches should be talking about all this, especially since we've got this nuclear armed Armageddonist accelerationist cult which is now pursuing the tearing up of international law and the massacre of the genocide in Gaza as well. Also worth mentioning because one of the key hotspots, and Kevin talks all about this in that interview, is the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the alleged site of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, and this is a very much a contested site, with the Al-Aqsa Mosque being constantly harried by the Israeli Defense Forces and the Israeli police, as a holy site in Islam. So this is obviously a bone of contention. The Third Temple movement wants to rebuild the Jewish temple. This is amongst very extreme nationalist Israelis. And that, of course, would precipitate a massive conflagration there. So, and this week we've seen the dedication by the chief of India, Modi, dedicating this new Hindu temple at Ayodhya on the site of a mosque. So very similar kind of sort of situation going on there. And you can see that these people, particularly these Hindu spokespeople, I shouldn't say that really, government spokespeople over in India, saying things like that this god Ram is the most important god in Hinduism. Well, it's not. You know, there's all sorts of others. Krishna's more important. Various other ones are important. And so they basically are doing exactly what many of these types of religions, ancient Canaanite style faiths do, is they pick whichever god it is that suits them at the time. And now for this week it's Ram, next week it might be somebody else, but this is a very, very important site for this Hindu god, apparently the most important god this week, and who knows what will be the most important god next week. So let's hope that these kind of degenerate ideas die a death at some point, because they are ancient, and this whole idea of a modern theistic faith, to me, this is where we are. There's this kind of contest basically going on between this once on the one side you've got this is amongst spiritual people, on the one side between good and evil, that is to say God and all those forces ranged against God, God's children, and obviously the Palestinians rank amongst those, and the other side is the kind of yin yang Hinduistic, etc., the Eastern kind of faiths, where you've got basically a whole panoply of gods, and you kind of choose whichever is your god. And the yin yang idea is really that you have have to have some kind of balance between good and evil. And so if you look at, say, for example, any politician who's answering a question, they seem to kind of fit into one or the other, not just a politician, a journalist, etc. So I think we need to just understand that there is this kind of divide and separation between those that understand that the world is framed around good and evil, that sin actually does mean something, and that then as against the whole idea of atheism and these multiple gods where you can just pick and choose which god you want. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and of course to Mal Sainsbury from the Bristol Allotment Campaign, and Roy Pomfrey from Stop Hinckley, also sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram if you wish. Do please send me interviews and story tips. You can even write to Martin if you like, via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, the full-length interviews from tonight and every other night. Those, by the way, will pop up on the app, if you've got the app too, when I upload the show around about 11 p.m. But usually by midnight, I've got all the extra, the full-length interviews too, if you want to hear from Catherine Gunn or Kevin Barrett, for example, tonight, plus others. There's also story links, the comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly newsletter at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, and on talkradio.org.uk stream. That's a stream you may be listening to now if you want to get straight to it. talkradio.org.uk, also at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the app. Restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us at 5 o'clock next Friday for Not the BCFM Politics Show. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
When I was born suspicious. Suspected of a crime that I didn't commit yet. But I just say bet. Maybe it's my DNA, my genetical breakdown, because I'm skin brown. Homie is the clown that we all love to see on TV. But homie, the clown ain't me, see? I kick the dips with cooler than Kool-Aid. And I can go off on the mic like a hand grenade. But still I chill because they expect me to have no respect for me, see? I ain't going out like a villain. I'm an anti-trigger, happy nigga that's chillin'. Wake up, it's time for the brothers to wake up. See through the makeup. They don't know me, but they fear me. Because I might be vicious. And I was born suspicious. When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
Damn, I can't even walk the streets at night without being harassed by the police. They say we all look alike. Well, that's a stereotype. Like P.E. said, don't believe the hype. Now they wanna rough me up and lock me down. They got my face in the crown. Black man with a phone in custody. So now they wanna take my fingerprints and ID.
It's not enough, they wanna rough me up and scuff me up. 14 police just to cuff me up. I guess there's no caviar dreams and champagne wishes when you're born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious. When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
1649 was in George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the wasteland grow. This earth divided, we will make whole, so it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the lands. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of grace who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroying their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the order came to cut them down.